Senate will come to order. Messages from the House.
February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 377, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 69, Fertilizers. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excused 2. February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 42, Select Committee on Local Government Financing. Ayes 58, excuse 2. Senate File 104, Life Insurance, Limitation on Dependent Coverage. Ayes 58, excuse 2. Senate File 124, Education Reserve Funding. Ayes 58, excused 2. And Senate File 146, NCAR Supercomputer Funding. Ayes 58, excused 2. February the 23rd, 2009. From the House of Representatives, message number 361, concurrence passed. Mr. President, the House did concur on Senate amendments to the bills listed below by the vote indicated. House Bill Number 8, Certified Public Accountants Revisions. Ayes 58, excuse 2. House Bill Number 38, Fiscal Year for Governmental Entities. Ayes 57, noes 1, excuse 2. House Bill 60, Sex Offenses by Correction Personnel. Ayes 58, excuse 2. House Bill 72, County Jails Release of Information. Ayes 58, excuse 2. House Bill 119, Genetic and Metabolic Disease Program. Ayes 57, noes 1, excuse 2. House Bill 138, Property Tax Refund Programs. Ayes 57, noes 1, excuse 2. House Bill Number 164, Prescription Drug Fraud Felony. Ayes 42, noes 16, excuse 2. House Bill 223, Bullying Prevention. Ayes 47, noes 11, excuse 2. House Bill 76, Election Code Revisions. Ayes 57, noes 1, excuse 2. February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 391, Joint Conference Committee Report adopted. Mr. President, Senate File 8. Feral Livestock. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excuse 2. February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 392. Joint Conference Committee report adopted. Mr. President, Senate File number 86, Revised Uniform Antinomical Gift Act. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excuse 2. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Concurrences. Senator Geis, are you ready on message 377?
Yes, Mr. President.
Would the reading clerk please read in the message?
February 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 377, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 69, Fertilizers. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, excuse 2. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, I move message 377 and ask for your concurrence and ask you to vote aye on Senate File 69, Fertilizers. What the House did is on page 5, after fertilizers insert, providing a portion of the Act is contingent upon sequence actions. And then on page 1, line 6, delete contingent and insert and. It's an and. And then on page 1, line 13, after the, insert governor, shall certify to the Secretary of State the occurrence of the publications of such final federal rules and section 2 of this Act shall be effective on the date that the certification is filed with the Secretary of State's office. Then on page 1, line 14 and 15, delete entirely and insert in preparing copy for printing and arranging and furnishing copies of this Act for the printer of the session laws of Wyoming statutes, the Legislative Service Office is authorized to display the provision of this Act in a manner which most. So I went to the LSO office, and this is what they told me that was good about these amendments. The House amendment to this bill is a certification of the notice process. This amendment will require that when the final federal rules are promulgated, the governor will certify the final rules to the Secretary of State, and the governor's certification will be the effective date of Section 2 of this bill. The LSO office will print and furnish copies as they do for the session laws on the statutes. So I would ask you to vote aye on message number 377, which is Senate File 69, Fertilizers.
The motion is that the Senate do concur on Senate File 69, message 377. Chief Clerk, and that you vote aye. Please, Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
Dicaria?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Honeycutt?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
Aye.
Schiffer?
Aye.
Scott?
Aye.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Hines?
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 29 ayes, 1 no.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 69. Senator Von Flatern, are you ready on message 375?
Yes, I am, Mr. President.
The clerk, reading clerk, please read in the message.
February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 375, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 73, Gillette-Madison Pipeline Project. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendment. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move message number 375, and I ask the Senate do concur, and I ask that you vote aye. The change they made is on page 5 after line 19, where the reversion is. It says presently it says unexpended funds appropriated under this subparagraph shall revert to the Permanent Trust Fund on July 1st, 2015, and they removed that, the reasoning being that if it is a loan, we'll be paying it back under the terms terms of the loan, so there's no reason that the money would revert, and you've basically borrowed the money from the bank. So I ask the Senate, please vote aye, and it's a minor change, and it fits in with what LSO had hoped we would do.
The motion is that you do concur on Senate File 73, message number 375, and that you vote aye. Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Esquibel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Honeycutt?
Aye.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Landon?
Aye.
Larson?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Massey?
Aye.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
Aye.
Perkins? Peterson,
aye.
Ross,
aye.
Schiffer,
aye.
Scott,
aye.
Sessions,
aye.
Townsend,
aye.
Vasey,
aye.
Von Platern,
aye.
President Hines.
Aye.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote to close. 29 ayes, 1 no.
By your vote, you have concurred on Senate File 73. Reports from standing committees.
February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 294, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, House Bill 294 that was just read in contains its prescription drug database. It contains an appropriation. I ask it be re-referred to committee number two.
Without objections, House Bill 294 will be re-referred to committee number two, appropriations. Considerations of bills in general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business. Considerations of bills in general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. President.
When we were last in session, we were working on House Bill 291. Is there further discussion? Are we ready for the question? Oh, Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions that I hope we can answer before we vote on this bill. One of them is we've heard a lot about the upper level and what happens with the insurance companies and about the middle level. But I would like some information about in the states that this has been a success. I'd like to know what kinds of businesses it created as small businesses and the kinds of the employment that was created. And then what are your latest figures on what's happened to those businesses, what's happened to those plans, and what's going on at this point in time in our economy?
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To answer that question, the industries that have received investments in other programs have included technology, telecom, manufacturing, life sciences, agriculture, transportation, oil and gas, and financial services. Over 20,000 jobs have been created and retained as a result of those programs in other states. There was one other thing that I'd like to bring up that was a question about where the monies go, premium taxes. About $20.5 million is collected in premium taxes from insurance companies in the state of Wyoming. The net that goes to the general fund in 2008 was $13.5 million. So the rest of those monies are being used for those other projects. And if we wish to make sure that or those other funding sources or for small groups or whatever, If we wish to make that clear, I'm sure we could do a second reading amendment in that regard.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, if this $20 million is going to create 20,000 jobs, then my recommendation is we ought to go back into the Business Council budget. Folks, we have $107 million going to business ready or grants and aid for the biennium, $50 million a year. If this was such a great job or program over what we were doing, then let's go change what we're doing out of that money and put it into this program. All this is a $20 million appropriation to the Business Council for purposes that they think are pretty exciting to be paid back later by somebody else in the next budget 4 or 5 years ago or now, or maybe getting natural gas prices are at $2 that day. Maybe they're $1, maybe they're $10. I don't know. But, I mean, if the notion is that here's a better program than we're using for $100 million, then take it out of the $100 million. The idea that you say, well, it's $20 million and it's free, and we'll worry about it in 5 or 6 years when somebody else is here, that's just not a good way to do business. That $13.5 million is in your goldenrod. It's in your general fund today. You'd have $2.5 million, $20 million over biennium. That's $5 million less to spend. Sure, it's creative. And every agency out there can find a creative way to take your general fund monies now and let it pay back later.
Senator Nicholas. Senator Bevout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify one point, the 20,000 jobs created would not be in the state of Wyoming. That was in the nationwide program for the nine states. And you make a great point. I mean, this is a situation that will exist in the year 2013. The $2.8 million may not be there to be covered by the 10% of the income. But I would submit to the members of this body that the hardest thing to do, particularly when you're in business, when times are difficult, is to step up and try to create things that will help you down the road. And that's what I think we're doing here. We're saying, today, there's an opportunity to take advantage of $20 million that could come into the capital account to try to create these jobs, to be proactive, to look to the future, and to see where we'll be. I think it's a good way to spend our money. I don't think it in any way conflicts with the Wyoming Business Council and what they're doing. I think it helps the Wyoming Business Council and what they're doing.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think it's really important if we look at that page 28. Now I understand it. It is, as the good senator from Fremont County said, 10% of the income. It says 10% of all distributions to the equity holders. Well, a distribution to an equity holder is a dividend. That's income. And so we're going to take 10% of the income. That is an income tax. You look at our Constitution, you've got a constitutional problem with that section. Because the Constitution says that if you have an income tax, you can take away all of the other taxes you pay first as a credit. All your property taxes that you pay, all your sales taxes that you pay, all your excise taxes that you pay, you can take that away before the state gets their money. And so, really, this is smoke and mirrors, because this 10% will never show up. Because you have all those deductions constitutionally that you can take away from this income tax. Because make no mistake, this is an income tax, because you're taking 10% of the equity that could be distributed. And equity is income. Dividends are income.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Kerria.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wanted to know, was $20 million, was that a magical number for some reason? I mean, did anybody think about starting at $5 million, see if the program works? If it works well, then you could come back and look at expansion of the program. I mean, it's not unheard of. We've done that before in the past. And while I'm up, Mr. Chairman, the other one was, you know, and I think I heard that somebody was going to guarantee some of this debt, somebody that owns a, you know, a large company and has most of the money in the United States that's in Omaha. I mean, is that going to go out for competitive bid, or is this just another, you know, reason for somebody? I know that he probably could use some extra cash, but I'm just trying to figure out why that company is the one that was named in this process.
Go to Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I had a couple of questions and a comment before lunch. I'll see if I can remember them. My first question had to do with the premium tax. As I can recall back in the 90s when we was looking for funds that we spoke about the increasing the premium tax. And as I recall, we was told that, well, it doesn't matter to us as insurance companies. That's just added on to premiums and the customers pay it. So my question is then, is there anything in this bill that has anything to do with a reduction for the customers? Or are they paying the premium tax and then the company getting the benefit for it? And then my next question goes on to page 8, the section on the top where you're talking about the liability incurred by 26-4-301. And as I read down there, that last sentence or part of a sentence, it refers to you can reduce it. This gives them reduction of the liability on a tax imposed by 26-4-301, which I believe is the premium tax. But then it ends by any other tax liability imposed upon a participating investor by the state. And I don't think this is your intent, that would refer to property tax, some other type tax. And I'm just asking that, and if it doesn't mean that, shouldn't it be clearer than it's written there?
Thanks, Senator Hines. Senator Bebout.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer a couple of those questions. First of all, about the investor that lives east of us, I misspoke, should not have used that particular name. The way this bill is drafted, it just gives an option to the people that invest in the investment, in this investment facility, that they can go out and buy a bond from somebody that has the funds to do the bond. They negotiate the rate of return, and that's something that's independent, has nothing to do with that specific company or that specific individual. It's just a tool that's available that if they want to do it, they can. There's some cost to that. That's up to them, and that's a private negotiation that they would do. As to the premium tax question, Mr. Chairman, there would be no reduction to the customers. As I see it, whatever the insurance department charges people as to their premiums would continue. You could argue that in 5 years, when we see the reduction come in to the premium, that they will have that credit, that if they don't have enough money to fund what they're supposed to fund, they may come back and say, we have to raise that premium tax, and that's certainly a possibility.
Thank you, Senator Larson.
No, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I would point out that the premiums regarding to most of that, they do come under the Wyoming Insurance Commission, and they're there, which the funding, other than those areas specified by Senator Scott, I believe, everything else goes into the general fund, so it is a general fund. But the bottom line is, yeah, we are taking a risk, albeit small. It is there. We can go on depending upon one industry, or we can try to do what I hear that the people of Wyoming want us to do and try to find ways to broaden our economy, which will increase tax. And even at the federal level, you hear, well, a tax cut, that's going to take money away. We can't balance the budget. We can't do it. That's the very argument that the federal government has been using, when, in fact, every time there's a tax cut, revenue increases because of the broadening of the economy. And the ability to then create more taxes, as was pointed out by the good senator from Fremont County, because of the increase in the sales tax, the property tax, all the other taxes that we pay. I will not argue with you whether or not a insurance tax is an income tax. I made that argument on another bill earlier, and you as a body decided it was not. And so I think with consistency, we kind of have to go the same way. But it's a chance to expand the Wyoming economy on, I think, a very creative way with minimal, not none, but minimal risk to the state of Wyoming. We can go on the same way we are, and we're going to get the same results, as one of our governors used to say. It's a chance to expand our economy, and it's a creative way, a very minimally risk to the state of Wyoming, and I think we should pass it.
Thanks, Senator Larson. Thank you for accusing us of being consistent. Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I will try to address the question from the good senator from Uinta County with regards to the figure of $20 million. Actually, we took that figure as a conservative figure based on Wyoming as it is and our low population and so forth. But and it is conservative. When you look at the amounts of monies in the other states that have done this, it is extremely low. Louisiana, 14 different programs, $550 million. Missouri, 140. New York, 340. Wisconsin, 50. Florida, 150 million. Colorado, 100 million. Alabama, 200 million. District of Columbia, 50 million. And Texas, 400 million. So I think that, you know, the 20 million is a fair number. I mean, I guess you could change it if you so desired. We thought that this was conservative, given what we know about the state of Wyoming. But also, you got to have enough out there to make it worthwhile. Because what we're talking about is investing in companies 200,000 to 3 million who may need that kind of influx of venture capital. So I think it's a pretty conservative number. And one in which is doable.
Thanks, Senator Ross. Are we ready for the question? All's in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 291, say aye.
Aye.
Suppose nay.
No.
So the Senate File 291 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 96. Will the reading clerk please read the file?
House Bill number 96, sponsored by Representative Buchanan, Railroad Quiet Zones, an act relating to railroads and public highway crossings. It was referred to Committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, reports back with a recommendation, favorable recommendation, that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee number 2, Appropriations. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Peterson, Townsend, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Thank you. Hear the reading of the bill. What is your question, Senator, or what is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have lots of questions, but for right now, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 96, Railroad Quiet Zones, and I'll refer to Senator Meyer to explain this fine bill.
Senator Meyer.
Mr. Chairman. This is a Railroad Quiet Zone bill. Presently, there's about 400 public railroad crossings in the state of Wyoming, and what this bill hopes to do is to create a program administered by the Transportation Commission called the Quiet Zone Program. It goes into a sub-account in the Transportation Department, and the Commission establishes a priority system for quiet zones and the installation of equipment at grade crossings, and it gives consideration to safety and other factors that are deemed relevant by the commission. It does that through rule and regulation, and there is a matching program, Mr. Chairman, that you'll see on page 2. I believe this is similar to the same type of matching program that we had in the library and challenge endowment program. It's based on the inverse assessed valuation where some of the counties match at 25%, some match at 50%, and others match at 75% of the cost, depending on what you can afford to put up in that.
It begins in October 2010, and what was explained in the committees in, from the Department of Transportation is that this is kind of done in conjunction with the federal government. There's a lot of hoops to jump through, and especially when you get into the areas of the safety, you have to deal with the railroad, and they're always a little problematic. The cost of the different quiet zone treatments, I did have passed out this morning a little sheet here, and it's got the different costs for the different ones. They range from about $370,000 to as low as $20,000. And that kind of depends on, you know, how many gates are out there already, how many bells and whistles are there, whether you use a wayside horn or whether you have it to where it's a totally silent type of a system. The need for this primarily is in the areas where you have a lot of heavy train traffic and you have a lot of crossings in going through some of the towns and just outside the towns. There are some municipalities that have four, five, or six of these crossings, and you'll have four to five trains come through every hour. And so if you look at it from that standpoint, you've got several hundred train whistles blowing all day long, and that kind of keeps people a little jittery, I think. And it's just not the coffee, yes. But what we're trying to do is initiate a program where we can start to address this impact that we have from our coal industry. And so with that explanation, there is a first standing committee amendment, and I think I turn it back over to the chairman of transportation so he can go through that.
Okay. Senator Rumpleiter.
Would you please read in standing committee number one?
House Bill 96, standing committee amendment number one to engross copy, page 3, line 11.
Senator Rumpleiter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move standing committee number one to House Bill 96. It goes to page 3, line 11. Apparently, the original numbers that were in the bill for the bottom seven counties in the list created so forth, there's eight counties in the bottom eight. So they wanted that changed to read eight, so that's what the amendment does. It also then goes on to line 19 and changes for the top. You had to take that county from somewhere. It changes that from top eight counties to top seven counties. This is the distribution of funds per the wealth in there. You go to line 4, or page 4, line 17, you change after 3710106 on line 17, you delete the balance of that line, delete the next line, and delete on line 19 all the way through 2010. That's the line that says funds under this section shall be for the period beginning with the effective date of this act and ending June 30th of 2010. Well, you didn't believe that they could actually get these funds, put it into place, or survey what they needed to do, find the projects, spend the money before next June, about 15 months after we leave here. So we deleted that on page 4, line 23, after purpose. We insert a period and delete the balance of that line. Go to page 5, lines 1 through 2, and delete those. This is the reversion clause. Once again, it had June 30th, 2010, at the end of this fiscal year coming up, and we didn't think that they'd be able to spend the money and take care of these projects, so we deleted that. Page 5, line 5, they had the exception budget in there, and they meant the next biennium budget, so we just crossed out the word exception. And page 5, line 8, we deleted the enactment date and just said that this act is effective immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for the bill to become law, so DOT and everybody could get going as soon as we have this signed by the governor if it should move forward. So I ask for your favorable recommendation and vote for standing committee number one.
Ready for the question on standing committee amendment number one? All those in favor of Senator von Flatern's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number one to Senate file 96, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Standing committee amendment number one is passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Nicholas. Please read in the second Standing Committee Amendment.
House Bill 96, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to engross copy, page 4, line 15.
Thank you. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 96. Folks, when the when you see these programs, I mean, I think part of the concern that folks have is it's simply another way of taking statewide dollars and allocating it to a specific community. We have block grants for communities, and if this is their highest priority, this is what those communities ought to be using that. Having said that, we do have some accounts out there that help some communities more than others, and one, for example, is the Industrial Road Program. You access those to have to help build roads that are accessed by industry, and we know that statistically, communities in the Southwest use those and have access to those monies more than others. So there are times where we do this. What we recommended is we reduce the appropriation to $50,000 to get it started, and that as we come in looking into the budget, then with this program started, then as we're doing working the budget and we're trying to decide allocations for things such as the industrial road programs, then this program can stand shoulder to shoulder with those programs. I urge your support of the amendment.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas. Further discussion, Senator Van Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Speaking on and against this amendment, there was a handout that showed you the various types of gates you could use. It looked something like this. And the cost, if you had to create that four-gate system right from scratch, or even if you just had some warning lights up at a semi-rural crossing, one that's on the edge of town, one that actually has a new subdivision built near it, if you had to start from scratch on that, $500,000 with a 25% match, giving you $875,000, would fund almost three, four quad gate systems. Or you could go with the wayside horns and you'd get as many as eight done. This is not community-specific bill. Yes, I can tell you Torrington would be a great recipient of this bill. But you have this problem in Worland, Grable. You have it in the Rock Springs area, anywhere the UP runs, if they don't already have this in place. The railroads are not very good at spending the money to take care of community issues such as this that they've created by their equipment. If we could only take care of three crossings in this state, and I know Torrington has a dozen or seven or eight or something. I remember there was an incredible amount of crossings in that one community. But Grable, Worland, and all those areas have that same issue. So this is open to the whole state to apply for. $50,000 won't even get them through the next $50,000 won't even get them through the next couple, 3 months. They have a little bit of survey work that'll probably take most of that $50,000 getting out there and just checking out which ones are and how much it'll cost to do each one and getting the priority list together. So I ask for your defeat of this, and let's keep the 500 in there and let's get something done in the next year.
Thank you, Senator Van Flatern. Senator Bebout?
Mr. Chairman, just a question, and I understand that the railroads caused a problem, and certainly they're doing well in this venture in terms of revenues and profits to their shareholders, but not getting into that. Did anyone ask the railroads to contribute, or is that something the 4R Act doesn't allow, or they just said no?
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and I could answer that question, but I don't think I want to very bad. actually, we did one of these in my Senate district, and yes, the railroads will. They don't put up much money. They put up a lot of consultation and visiting and things like that. But they're very helpful, very, very helpful. Mr. Chairman, on the amendment, and let's remember, folks, as I recall, the block grant to counties, block grant in this biennium, was, I believe, around $123 million. Now, that'll build quite a few railroad crossings. Do the survey work. And what the railroad doesn't contribute, you know, if they get stretched, it'll make up for that. If it's a priority, but what you're doing with the way this bill is constructed, you're taking it away from the priority established by the Highway Commission.
No, you're not.
It doesn't make sense. If this is important to counties, let them allocate the block grant that they got in the 300 series. That's what it's there for. That's why we don't put strings on it. If railroad crossings are it, fine. Whatever they want to spend it on, they can spend it. It's just a question of priorities. And it just seems to me that let them work through it. We're not even a year into the biennium. And already we're saying, gee, that system isn't going to work. Give it time to work. Give it another year, whatever we got left, a year and a half in the biennium, and let them make the kind of allocation that suits them. And if it's railroad crossings, they can use it for railroad crossings. That's okay. I think the $50,000 appropriation is right on target.
Thank you, Senator Schiffer. Ready for the question, Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find myself up here not being particularly beneficial to my own community. I tell you, my own community does derive a lot of benefit from shipping out 400 some million tons of coal. I can tell you that certain communities don't get that same benefit at times. They do through the greater spread of the wealth of the state, but they also see that impact. They don't see some of the other impact we do with the influx and outflux of workers depending upon the economy and the value of our commodities. But they do. These other communities do see the impact from this one issue, which is above and beyond what should be in their block grant allocation from the state, because it is a specific issue to five or six communities in this state. They should have the money to take care of this, since the coal trains that are rumbling through their community, and I can tell you the town of Torrington gets shook regularly in about every 20 minutes by a train at one of the other crossings, that they should be able to take care of that, because the benefit from those coal trains is coming to all of us, and they do share in part of it, but they specifically have a problem. This shouldn't be compared to the county block grants. That's another issue, and everybody gets to spend that money as they should. We're not telling the Highway Commission that they need to spend what they have on these. We're giving them some money and telling them to allocate that money to take care of those problems. So I ask that we defeat the amendment, give them enough money so in this next year we get some of these issues answered. And by the way, this has been up 3 years in a row now. It's not a new problem. It's been there for years. And I hope we defeat the amendment so we can get something done.
Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you. I'm just going to speak for a moment in regard to the nature of my district and the nature of some of the communities involved and whether or not they might be able to do this through the community block grant or through the county allocation. But if you stop and think for a minute, I don't know the exact statistic, but more than 40% of the coal that fires the power plants of these United States come out of the Powder River Basin, and a lot of it flows south. I realize some goes. But as it flows south, it comes out of the Powder River Basin about Orange Junction. Now, one train doubles back and goes back to Dave Johnson, going through Douglas that way. But for the most part, these trains carrying this 40% of all the coal, or approximately 40% of all the coal used in these other distant locations, go down through Niobrara County from Orange Junction, or they go down through Platte on to Texas and that way. Well, you look at those counties, those are hardship counties. Those are small counties being Niobrara, Platte, and Goshen. And there's a significant number of small communities, and we say that this might be special communities or select communities or might even be implied to be special legislation, but you look at the number of small towns along there and what that implies to them. If you were to live in Glendale, and you lived at the most distant street in that small town from the railroad, it would still be almost like living next to the railroad tracks. And then if you lived in Torrington, which is kind of built along the tracks like a lot of small communities, you have a train going through there. I think it used to be every 20 minutes, and I think that's increased now. They're building double track, triple track, and whatnot to feed those lines going out. And so you're going to have a train going by your house in excess of every 20 minutes. And that's true in Lusk. And I won't even mention the other little burgs along the way, but it's also true in Glendale. It's true in Wheatland. It's true in Chugwater, all down through there. And so I would just encourage you to really think for a moment in regard to the impacts, the negative impact that these small communities incur as a result of our ability to supply a large part of the nation with coal, and commensurately we benefit from the revenues of that, and what those communities and what they get in return and some of the hardships that they might encounter. So with that, I would just ask your favorable consideration for the bill and think about this amendment quite carefully.
Thank you. Senator Hunnicutt.
Mr. Chairman, I signed on to the bill even though I live out in the county. I live about 4 miles by crow flight from the city of Cheyenne. And at night, I can hear the trains going from one brand of railroad to the other brand of railroad right down through town here. Every block, there's signals, there's gates, there's everything blaring and going, and they still blow the horn. And they seem to always want to do it at night. And there's also a brand of railroad that goes to the Air Force Base that stops just before it gets into the Air Force Base because it has to be inspected. And it will sit there and blow its horn until somebody comes to relieve these guys or to be able to cross one street out in the middle of the county. I look at this as noise pollution that needs to be dealt with, and I think we should deal with it for all communities, just not the coal communities. A lot of people lose a lot of sleep at night, and I can hear them, and it wakes me up. And if it can wake me up, I'm thinking, wow, how loud is that when you're about one block away? And I don't see any purpose for it. I mean, you got gates, you got lights blaring. If somebody's stupid enough to take on a train, then, you know.
Thank you, Senator Hunnicutt. Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm most concerned about the lights on these trains.
Thanks for sharing. Okay. Are you ready for the question on Standing Committee Amendment number 2? All's in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion that to adopt Standing Committee Amendment number 2 to House Bill 96, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The Standing Committee Amendment has passed Committee of the Whole. We're on back on the bill. Oh, a division being called for. All those in favor of Standing Committee Member 2, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, please rise.
John, did you mean to stand up?
Yes.
All those, thank you. All those in favor and against, please arise.
Kind of out of your element.
It's a tie. What happens when it's a tie?
It's not a tie.
It's failed. Okay, that's...
No,
it's passed. I'm sorry. Standing Committee Member 2 has passed.
No, it can't.
It's a pie? No, it's failed. Okay, one Standing Committee Member 2 has failed. I stand corrected. We're back on the bill.
We've narrowed it down.
Senator Vasey.
Mr. Chairman, I think... trains have been running through Wyoming, especially the southern part, for 145 years. The framers of the Constitution have about 2 pages in our Constitution about the railroad, and none of them talk about whistles. I think this bill is probably premature. I think we study it another 145 years, we'll probably be just about right. In all honesty, there's been people that live in section houses along the main line where the train ran from here to the good Senator Sweet. You know, and I don't know that we'd have changed it for them. It's just a matter of fact. You live on the track, you hear the whistle.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, my question is with regard to the testimony in committee, if there was any, as to whether these, on the safety aspect of these quiet zones. Mr. Chairman, I can remember reading in some of the rail trade press that the early attempts at quiet zones resulted in significantly more grade crossing accidents, which are usually very hard on the automobile involved and the occupants thereof. Those things are kind of big to argue with. But I don't know whether the newer technology has reduced those to insignificant levels, or whether we are creating a significant safety hazard by forbidding the whistles, because the first attempt sure did, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Senator Geis.
If we go to this no whistle blowing, what that means is you put double arms down on both sides of the track and you cannot go around them.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I've brought the exchange students that I had introduced before lunch, they're sitting down here, and as many of them know, Sheridan just instituted a quiet zone on Fifth Street right at its main crossing. And I was looking at this handout that was here, and the number of the different things offered and put out about gates and wayside horns and so forth, a couple hundred thousand dollars. And through a lot of research by the city of Sheridan, one of the things they found, if you have those double gates already, you can drive around those. So what they did was they just set back markers, elevated markers between the lanes so they could not drive through there. And as long as they get them back 75 feet, then the train horns don't have to be used. And I'm trying to figure out, with it, with the exception of most crossings, I don't understand, and that's a heck of a lot cheaper than wayside horns or any of the other alternatives offered here. I also would echo my fellow members here who are saying that you're basically bypassing the regular, not only the regular appropriations process, but also that of SLIB. Things like this is exactly why we give money to SLIB.
Thanks, Senator Burns. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First on the safety aspect of it there and the different costs. There's a current program now, it's a safety program, and what it does, it seeks to take on a priority basis established by their department the different crossings where they're not as safe as they should be, and they may need a single arm, or they may need a double arm, or they may need, as the good senator from Sheridan said, a barrier to prevent people from driving from one lane to the other lane to get around. There's, I think, somewhere between 4 to 7 of those that the department tries to go through and upgrade those every year. And sometimes they upgrade them with the double arms, sometimes they upgrade them with the other ones, and that gives you the differences on what you have to, the add-on difference to make it a quiet zone and to make it a safe quiet zone. So these are safe quiet zones. There's no doubt about that. And the price basically ranges from $20,000 if you just have to add the barrier, to more if you had to add the arms, or more if you do a wayside horn. And that really goes to the department, and it's prioritized. And looking back, I guess, as to the discussion about whether or not cities, towns, and counties should spend this money out of their own budget, whether it's derived from their local taxes or whether it's derived from someplace else, there are areas that are impacted more by some of this industrial development, but receive no sales tax from the industrial development. And this is a way to say, okay, in certain areas, and we did agree with that perspective in both the travel committee and in the Joint Appropriations Committee, is that in certain circumstances, there are times when you can say that there are expenses that other communities don't have to spend. And so how do you allocate for that? And this is just a bill that allocates for those special circumstances where some people are impacted more than others.
Senator Meyer, thank you. Senator Nicholas?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, these facilities, as they expand, also offer more property taxes, and in many instances, these are the highest-paying property taxes in the community. And with judicious local resources, they can apply those monies to solve the problems that exist. And we put a lot of money in the business-ready communities. To the local entities, everybody has unique problems. Ancient community, you sit down, you think about what it is. And this is just another way of saying, you know, we don't want to take our resources and make this the highest priority. We'd rather do it something else, and we would like you guys to pick up this priority. And I'd urge that you reject the bill.
Thank you. Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Answer a couple of questions just to the tall senator from Natrona County. These have been proven to be, they've changed them. Basically, a car can't get through. You have to either median strip or four gates to stop that. To the good senator from Carbon County, when they used to live by the tracks in Torrington, I can tell you probably 25 or 30 years ago, it was a train a day. Now it's a train every 20 minutes. You still may live there 25 or 30 years later, so there's impact that you never bought your property believing it existed. The cost on that back page is that handout that was given to you. Tells you what you need to do, basically stop the car from being able to get on the tracks and the cost associated depending on what is already in place. This is no funds, no additional funds come to these communities because a coal mine was placed in Campbell County, which, you know, we thank them every day for all the ad valorem and other taxes that come to our county because of it. But if you're down the tracks or you live in Cheyenne and you have those same, partially those same trains plus other freight trains to deal with, you're not getting one more penny from that facility built up in Campbell County other than what comes in the form of severance tax and federal mineral royalties to the state, which is doled out equally to all the communities, and yet you have this specific problem, which is sitting in Grable, Warland, sitting in Cheyenne, sitting in Torrington, Glendale, whatever, Douglas. So I ask for you to favorable vote on the bill, and let's move it forward.
Ready for the question?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Ron Flatern's motion that when the committee hold rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 96, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Division. Okay, division having been called for, all those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. Pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed standing division with vote, a roll call vote is required. The Chief Clerk will call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
DeCaria?
No.
Dockstader?
Aye.
Esquivel?
Aye.
Geis?
Aye.
Hastert?
Aye.
Honeycutt?
Aye.
Jennings?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Landon,
aye.
Larson,
no.
Martin,
aye.
Massey,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
no.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Ross,
no.
Schiffer,
no.
Scott,
no.
Sessions,
no.
Townsend,
aye.
Basie,
no.
Von Flatern,
aye.
President Hines,
no.
Closing vote. Closing. Vote closed. 14 ayes, 16 noes.
Okay. Is there anything else I say? Senate File 96, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 41. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill number 41, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer, cremation expenses, an act relating to public assistance programs. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Thank you. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move from the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 41 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments. I yield to Senator Honeycutt for an explanation of this good little House bill.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Senator Honeycutt.
Fellow Senators, Mr. Chairman, this is a bill you should be able to get fired up about. It's not encrypted and shouldn't bury it. So the county... Boy, it took a while. the county coroners came to us with this little bill, and it's a serious one. It's a lot of people who are on welfare, who families don't have enough money to have the burial themselves. They'll go to the county and ask the county to take care of the burial expenses. Well, nowadays, a lot of people are doing cremations, and the coroners came to us, wanted us to add the wording of or cremation. We've added that to page one right after burial. We've also added that to page two, line 15, where it says burial or cremation. It's pretty straightforward. Some families want cremation, some don't. It's a little less expensive than doing a full casket and a full plot in a cemetery. That wasn't really their concern. It was just that they could meet the needs of some of these families. And with that, I would ask for your favorable vote.
Thanks, Senator Hunnicutt. Discussion on the bill. We're ready for the question. All's in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee hold rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 41, say aye.
Aye.
Suppose nay. House Bill 41 has passed committee of the whole. Our next bill for our consideration is House Bill 42. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 42, sponsored by Representative Dave Zwanitzer, Burial Arrangements, an act relating to burials and cremations. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Hunnicutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Thank you. Excuse me, you've heard the reading of the bill, Senator Scott. What is your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so the recommendation that House Bill 42 do pass. There was a standing committee amendment asked to be read in at this time.
Please read the amendment.
House Bill 42, standing committee amendment number 1 to engross copy, page 4, line 1.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move adoption of the standing committee amendment. Mr. Chairman, the standing committee amendment just takes care of a such. A little language correction. I urge its adoption.
All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that we approve standing committee amendment number 1, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Standing committee amendment 1 has passed. Senator Scott.
Chairman, I yield the Senate. Co-sponsor of this good little House bill, Senator Case.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, it's all about the dead and dying today, I'll tell you. Mr. Chairman, this has to do with the arrangements that you might wish to have happen to you after you've departed. And if you, for a lot of people, they have not left any instructions about how they want to be buried or cremated. You know, this is a pretty important thing to some people, especially with respect to religious requirements. They may have particular religions don't embalm. Some religions don't permit cremation. So it is a very important thing. It's also something that sometimes families don't always get along about, Mr. Chairman. And I guess you could think of the purpose of this bill as being akin to the living will requirements that you might have for your hospitalization. What happens if you can't, if you require artificial life support, what should happen? I mean, there's a little bit of akin to that. Who makes decisions for you? That's all in the law, and we have a living will document. This, in essence, creates the same body of law that says these are the people in this order that can decide your burial arrangements. And you can just take a look. The gist of the bill is on page 2, Mr. Chairman, where it lists this priority of folks that can make decisions for you. And you can see that it's your spouse, it's your children, then it's your parents, then it's a sibling, then the grandparents, stepchilds, goes on and down. And it explains what happens and what course funeral directors have to follow if there's a conflict between these people. And that's the gist of the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer any questions. There was at one time in this bill a actual permission slip. It was kind of included to be done in the law, but that can also be part of the living will that we already have that has a similar arrangement already in law. So, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions. There's really not much to this when you think about it. There's one more thing I should mention, though, that it does grant immunity from criminal or civil liability for funeral directors that follow this directive. So if somebody else on the list comes in and wants to sue about, you know, they had Granny buried and she was supposed to be cremated, but if she's still alive, we do have a problem, actually. But, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill.
Thank you. Question? Discussion? Senator Burns.
She may be alive, but she's not well. Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious. Since we are now setting out this list of priorities, this will go into statute. This will become the law. So do we have to wait for adjudication, for instance, between, let's say, for instance, on number 2, Romanet 2, the adult child of the decedent? If there, what if there are more than one child? What if there are four children and they equally split between each other? How has that worked? Or does it automatically default down to the...
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, we wait for adjudication right now. That's exactly what happens. If there's a conflict, there's no way to determine a priority now. Basically, anybody that walks in the door sort of has the same standing. And so literally the final disposition of the body is put off until a court, there's a court order. If there is a conflict, and someone can go to court and get a court order, but that's not much difference than what we have right now. This makes it a lot easier because you can follow the list. And, yes, you can go to court and challenge the list. And, yes, if there's a conflict within a category, there can still be a court action required. But it is much, much better than what we have now.
Thanks, Senator Case. Senator Burns?
No. Mr. Chairman, I'm not criticizing the bill. It's a good bill, and I think we should be doing something like this. The question I have, it says there if they're equal, if the number of equal of children equal and all that, then it's adjudicating court. The problem I have is that by this bill, what a judge tries to do is they try to figure out what the intent of legislature was and so forth. And it seems to me we are not giving them any direction as far as that's concerned. And I don't know that there's a fair way to do it, but I'm just kind of concerned that we're sort of leaving that hanging out there.
Thank you. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, if you look in the bill on page 3, starting at line 15, undertakers shall act in accordance directly with the greatest number of consents received members of the class, and you've got your classes and priority. Number is equal, director acts in accordance with the earlier consent, unless the so that takes care of most of your conflicts. Unless the person providing later consent gets an order from the court, district court shall order disposition in accordance with the later consent only if it's shown by preponderance of evidence that disposition is in accordance with the decedent's wishes. So I think we've given the court perfectly clear direction. If you're going to upset the priority, you've got to come in and show that the decedent had, by a preponderance of evidence, that the decedent had wished something else.
For the discussion, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 42, say aye. Those opposed, nay. House Bill 42 has passed committee of the whole.
Senator Ross.
Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 289. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
House Bill Number 289, sponsored by Representative Mercer, Child Protection Hearings, and Act Relating to Child Protection Cases. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Perkins?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, they do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 289. And for an explanation of the bill, I guess we go to me. There is an amendment. If we could go ahead and read that in at this time, we'll.
House Bill 289, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 1.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 289 and request that we dispense with further reading of the amendment. And if, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, I'd explain the bill and the amendment at the same time. What you've got here, a little bit of background, is in the Department of Family Services, in cases of abuse or neglect, there's been some confusion about whether or not they can issue a final agency determination with respect to the accusations of abuse or neglect. And in their rules and regulations at this point in time, the Department of Family Services anticipates that the actual final determination will be made by the Office of Administrative Hearings. And because that's the way it seems to be implied in the statute now, and that's the way that their rules are, over the period of time, what you found is you go to the trouble to have a hearing on abuse or neglect. The Department of Family Services does this investigation. They go and ask for a final determination. It's done at the Office of Administrative Hearings. That if that goes well for the Department of Administrative Services, that there is a fine of abuse and neglect, then that can be appealed by the one side. On the other side, however, if the Department of Family Services loses, or there, what I mean by that is losing, is that there is a finding that there is not an abuse or neglect by the Office of Administrative Hearings, then according to their rules, the Department of Family Services can then overrule the Office of Administrative Hearings. And so that's happened about five times in the last several years, and it kind of creates a situation where people wonder why would you go to the trouble to have a hearing on that if ultimately the department can simply overrule the hearing. So what this bill does is it simply creates, and with the amendment what it does is that we take on the bottom of page 1, line 17, at the very end of that, we would strike the word for. Page 1, line 17, after the word neglect, on page 1, line 17, after the word neglect, we would insert by a registered mail or service, and after hearing, insert on the agency's determination. And the purpose of this is what we would do is ultimately we want this bill is going to make it so that Provident Family Services will make a final determination with respect to abuse or neglect. That determination will be served either by personal service or registered mail on the person accused of the abuse or neglect. And then from there, it will go, and the Office of Administrative Hearings will basically rule on the final determination and to see if there's evidence, the evidence to support that finding by the Department of Family Services. The other thing that the bill does with the amendment is that it also gives the DFS the opportunity to appeal if there is adverse determination to either party, either the parent or custodian that's accused of abuse and neglect, or the Department of Family Services. Either one can appeal from the Office of Administrative Hearings under the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act, and that appeal, of course, would then be to the district court. With that, the purpose of this then is that we'll ensure that the Department of Family Services can make a final determination with respect to abuse or neglect, and that both sides will then have an opportunity to have that appealed if they believe that there has been a substantial miscarriage of justice. With that explanation, I'd stand for questions, and barring none, I'd ask your favorable consideration on the Standing Committee Amendment at this time.
Any discussion on the Standing Committee Amendment? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of the Standing Committee Amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment's been adopted. We're back on the bill. Is there any further discussion on House Bill 289. Are you ready for the question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Perkins' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 289 is passed Committee of the Whole.
Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 83. Will the reading clerk please read the bill? We destroy the counter.
House Bill 83, sponsored by Representative Throne, Governmental Immunity, Public Transportation, an act relating to governmental claims. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highway, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Landon, Von Fladern. No, Senator Guy, Senator Von Fladern, Chairman.
Thank you. You've heard of the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Fladern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 83. And to explain the bill, I'll call on myself.
Senator Von Fladern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Governmental Immunity Public Transportation. On the first page on line 3 and 4, or actually in the whole beginning there, an act related to government, extending the Wyoming Governmental Claims Act to governmental entities in other states and to operate public transportation programs in Wyoming under specified conditions. You go to page 2, talks about local governments, and adds and goes to the definition we have. And then on line 12B, it says, includes a governmental entity of another state operating a public transportation program when the other state has, by written agreement, extended or agreed to extend its governmental immunity or other limitations of liability to Wyoming for purposes of public transportation programs. Right now, when somebody's in, some public entity has a transportation entity, such as a van pooling, and they operate in the state, they're covered by governmental immunity. So they have the same liabilities, the same $250,000 coverage. Once they leave the state and cross into another state, they lose that. Now, these are nonprofits run by governmental entities, and they try to keep the price to the minimum, basically the maintenance and operation of that vehicle. They want, if they have to buy an insurance policy, the insurance policies tend to be very expensive because they take on full liability when that vehicle leaves the state in which it has governmental immunity and enters another. This is very important for our corner communities, our Cheyennes. Will be for Torrington when the prison opens up, and if the local county, city, town sets up some kind of van pooling, commuter vans that will run back and forth to take employees to Scotts Bluff or back, or Scotts Bluff does the same thing. I really, you know, it's hard to imagine that Torrington will have all the employees of the prison. There won't be some across the border. The other place that's very important, and they've already run into this problem, is in Teton County. Jackson runs its own, Teton County runs its own bus system. They take their workers across to Driggs, Idaho, or get them from Driggs, bring them over, and bring them back at night. They have to pay an enormous amount of insurance once they cross the border. So if Teton County gets with the county in Idaho, the county that they border, they both agree. Remember this, they both have to agree. So if an Idaho public entity was running a transportation system and wanted to enter Wyoming, just Teton County, if that's all they made their agreement with, we will extend governmental immunity to the Idaho company or government, county government, city, municipal, whatever we sign with. The governmental entity here, Jackson or Teton County, whoever signs the agreement, will be able to take their buses over to get their workers. So they have to, two governmental entities will have to sign an agreement for reciprocity of governmental immunity when you cross the border. It would not allow that entity from Idaho to drive to Cody. They would only be covered in the area they've signed an agreement with, which would be Teton County. The same with Laramie County. It would sign an agreement with Weld County south of here and extend the governmental immunity for a Cheyenne van pooling outfit to go down to Fort Collins. The same thing from Fort Collins to come to Cheyenne. They would be covered by governmental immunity when they cross the border. So it has to be two counties, two cities, two towns signing the agreement and specifying the route that's involved. It also goes on to 22 to say the public transportation program is operated by a governmental entity in the other state and a local government in this state as defined by Wyoming statute. It goes on to say the routes are beginning and ending or passing through Wyoming, so they have to be defined in the agreement. And for a public transportation program, it means a not-for-profit program designed to transport passengers to and from work or to another location on a regularly scheduled basis where the passengers have a commonality of purpose. This is not just a bus system that drops them off for shoppers over here, workers over there, running errands. It has to be for commonality of purpose for everybody within that van or bus. And they are using vehicles operated by a government entity where no charge is made to the passengers other than that reasonably calculated to recover direct and indirect costs. Remember, this is a nonprofit. They are trying to keep the price down to keep the commuters from having to pay for 55 cents a mile is what the IRS allows on your vehicles. It's to, you know, so a round trip Fort Collins, 120 miles, give or take. You can see that it's about $60. A day at the IRS rate for depreciation, for wear and tear, and for your gasoline. It's to get those cars off the road if possible and have six or seven of those people in one van. And to get that price down to costing those people $50 or $60 or $80 or $100 a month. It's for somebody in Teton County to be able to provide transportation because the average worker probably can't afford to live in Teton County and they live across the border in Idaho. but they still have to get to and from work, and that's an expensive trip over that big hill. So that's what this bill does. It allows them to sign an agreement to extend that governmental immunity so those vans and buses can operate at the least expense, keep the people, as many commuters in one vehicle as possible, and keep the price down. So I ask for your favorable vote on House Bill 83.
Thanks, Senator Unflater. Questions? Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I urge you to carefully consider what this bill does. What this bill is intending to do, and I'm familiar with it, and I've tried to work through this and tried to understand it with our Metropolitan Planning Organization here in Cheyenne, which is a prime supporter of this bill. But what it does is that we are going to extend our governmental immunity to citizens in another state. We're going to give them our governmental immunity. Now, the way it works right now is that there is a Metropolitan Planning Organization in northern Colorado that provides, they're a kind of a quasi-governmental entity. They get federal funding. We have a Metropolitan Planning Organization here in Cheyenne, and those are for locales under the federal statutes that have 50,000 people or more. In essence, what happens in this situation is in Colorado, their MPO in Colorado has these vans, and it's called VanGo. And they let these vans out to Colorado people, and they're generally assigned to a group of, let's say, 6-7 different people. They're assigned the vehicle. They get to drive it for low cost, and then they get to drive up to Wyoming in that van to work in Wyoming. And we're going to extend our governmental immunity to those people. Now, if an accident happens, which is unfortunate sometimes, but if an accident happens, those passengers in that vehicle will have only the right to collect under the Governmental Claims Act. In Wyoming, that's $250,000. Effectively, that it works out to less than that because that's the max they can pay. And generally, in these cases where the state is at risk, they have nothing to lose but to go to trial at $250,000. You're generally held hostage to settle for less than that. So if you have a quadriplegic or something in one of these vans, what we have done is said, okay, Colorado person, the most you can collect is $250,000 if you're coming to Wyoming. My point is, why don't we encourage them to come and live in Wyoming if they're working in Wyoming? Unfortunately, I guess that's not a doable situation. They don't want to live in Wyoming. They sure do like to work in Wyoming. So we're going to afford them our governmental immunity. I just cannot get beyond that concept of where we're going to extend our own governmental immunity, which we extend to our own people. If this is within the state of Wyoming, it's fine. But do you want to extend governmental immunity to somebody outside of the state of Wyoming that we have no control over, that we have nothing to do with them? There's a whole different entity. So we're going to have these agreements, apparently, between these MPOs or perhaps other governmental entities, where we're going to, everybody that's involved in this thing gets governmental immunity. I suggest to you that I don't think that that's good public policy. And in the end game, we end up paying more. We end up paying more if the individuals that are in these vans get hurt, because they don't have any right of recovery. Now, in my business, what we do is we represent certain bus companies that transport workers to and from the mines. And we've had a number of accidents that I've been involved in defending. They don't get immunity. They have to pay if they hurt somebody. How far, what is the next extension of this? So, do what you will with it, but I just have some real problems in extending our governmental immunity to foreign citizens.
Thanks, Senator Ross. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My answer is, do we want to give them governmental immunity? My answer is yes. In almost every instance, they are workers from Wyoming. It's easy to say, well, just move into Wyoming. I'm sorry, but that's not possible everywhere, folks. Can't be done. There isn't housing. You've heard us, you know, talk about housing. There's a lot of reasons that can't happen. They wish they could. I wish they could. And the governments who were providing this, in our case at least, wish they could. But they're vital to the operation of the businesses within our county. There is not a business that can do that, that can pool those. In a few cases, it is being done. It's being done by some of the ski areas who have the numbers to be able to hire a bus to be able to do that. But when they're spread out throughout the community, you can't hire a bus and have them come and get your people. It takes traffic off the roads. It takes traffic off the roads, makes the roads safer. And these people are contributing to the state of Wyoming. They're employees, in most cases, of the state of Wyoming. The agreement has to be with another governmental unit that can do the same thing. And I believe it's a solution to a problem where you cannot get employees, where the employees have to drive themselves in highly dangerous conditions very often, and it is can become a safety issue, it can become a cost issue, and it can be very important in attempting to get some valuable employees who would rather, in many cases, live in the state of Wyoming, but who can't for various either availability or financial situations. And so I would suggest to you that's absolutely proper that we do that to help make things better for our workers.
Thank you. Senator Townsend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question of the sponsors of this bill as well. My question is, would it be possible through this bill to provide immunity to the drivers of buses with the senior citizen centers that deliver our dialysis patients out of state for their treatments? And if so, would it work for that type of a transportation?
Thank you, Senator Townsend. Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I answer the easy problem first. As far as the senior centers go, they will have to work with their local government entity to become part of that in some manner. I put this forward to the attorneys and asked them, would this fit in? Because ideally, we've just run into the Y-Trans group that has now been told, leaving Newcastle in particular, that they don't have any coverage when they hit the South Dakota line, and they do 3 or 4 days a week to the dialysis center in Rapid City with their members. So they'll have to work something to get them under the nonprofit governmental entity part of this bill. And right now they're not part a governmental entity. So no at this moment. You have to remember this has reciprocity to it. It is not just their advantage coming here. You also have to remember that we do need the workers. And as the good senator from Teton County said, they can't always live here. I would suggest to you that the ideal scenario is that they do live in another state and work here. You know, we'll get the benefit of the product they put out and let the other state educate them. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just bringing that point to you as a comment on our tax system. But that's the truth. Once again, our people get the benefit of this. Our people get to keep that price down so they can drive themselves or get into a public bus system sponsored by a governmental agency and drive across the border, and then they are covered. Got to remember, it goes both ways on this. The other part of it is this is nonprofit. When we talk about buses that haul coal miners, it's a for-profit. They put the risk into there. They charge accordingly. These people are trying to keep that price down. $160 a month versus $1,100 a month to round trip Fort Collins. It keeps the vehicles off the road. One vehicle versus six, seven, or eight vehicles doing that same job. There's a lot of good reasons for this bill. This bill should pass. I hope it will. and ask for your favorable vote.
Thank you, Senator Von Flader and Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, I was the no vote on this bill. And you got to start looking here. You're looking at interstate commerce. There's a lot of things you're looking at here that nobody's telling you, and I don't know how it's going to turn out. None of these drivers have CDLs. None of them are drug tested. I'm telling you, it's pretty risky.
Thanks, Senator Geis. Further discussion, are we ready for the question? Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one follow-up. In a perfect world, we'd have all these people living in Wyoming, but it's not a perfect world. Especially on the west side of the state, we've got to fill these jobs, but we don't have the places for them to live that's affordable. So this addresses a problem that, an economic problem. It puts people in jobs and allows them to still find a place to live that's affordable.
Thanks, Senator Dockstader. Further discussion? Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flader's motion when the committee whole rises to report that it is with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 83, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
All those in favor of the bill, please rise. All those opposed to the bill, please rise. Okay, somehow the mouth worked out on that. House Bill 83 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 71. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 71, sponsored by Representative Berger. Film Industry Financial Incentives, an act relating to film industry incentives. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
Thank you. For the reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 71. And to explain this fine piece of legislation, I'd like to call on Senator Coe.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, House Bill 71 goes into the Film Industry Financial Incentive Program, and I'll draw your attention to a handout that I distributed on Friday. Back in 2007, we passed a cash rebate program for production companies of up to 15% if they spent at least $500,000 in the state of Wyoming. One of the advantages of this is that when a film company comes into the state, they significantly impact the local economy. They hire locally. They have rentals. They have purchases. Viewing Wyoming locations, destinations is also a benefit. What this bill does, it lowers that threshold from $500,000 down to $200,000. There's been significant interest in film companies coming to Wyoming in the $200,000 to $250,000 range, but they don't qualify right now. We have had very little success with the $500,000 threshold. So all the bill does is lower that threshold for a cash rebate of up to 15% from $500,000 down to $200,000. Requires no additional appropriation. The estimated increase is actually an increase to the general fund through sales tax, and they're figuring on at least one new film production a year. And that's what the bill does. I try to answer questions.
Thanks, Senator Cole. Senator Lars Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a couple of questions of the committee or the sponsors of the bill. It was really quite a large headline last year when this came up. We had a cable company come to Wyoming to produce a movie, which actually debuted over the weekend. I don't know how many of you might have seen that, about one of our Wyoming fallen heroes. Unfortunately, it was filmed all in a state to the north of us. And at that time over the dinner table, I can remember asking, well, wait a minute, I thought we had a film industry incentive program in Wyoming. I thought, so I guess my question would be, what happened with that particular film or films like it? And then second of all, whether or not there was discussion in committee or during the interim about what are some of these other states doing that they're able to get an actual biographical story which took place in our state to be filmed somewhere else. Just wondering if this bill is really going to cut the mustard or not.
Thanks, Senator Landon. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, you're going to have to, I may get corrected on this, but as I recall, they originally wanted to film that movie where it took place in the Du Bois area, and the problem they ran into was an infrastructure problem. There wasn't enough, they didn't have enough communications capacity in that area, so they went into the state to our north instead. It really, they took a look at the film incentive program, and it was attractive to them. The state as it stands right now really can't compete just on the incentive program itself. There's a number of larger states, and actually even countries to the north of us that, have much greater incentives from a money standpoint. But Wyoming has its own unique qualities, and one of the things we're trying to do with this program, which is only a few years old, is trying to find the niche that the state fits in, which is why this bill is lowering that threshold down to 200,000, because we have had quite a bit of, or the tourist office actually has had quite a bit of interest from the smaller filmmakers.
Thanks, Senator Burns. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our film incentive program is small compared to many other states. We don't have, it's the old story. If we're not taxing them in the first place, we can't give them back much, and so they don't look at the credit that is out there. The larger films, I don't think we can ever compete with, for example, British Columbia that gives huge incentives. Montana gives pretty good incentives. They're better than ours. But it's come to the attention, I think, of the Film Commission and the others that these small things, even commercials, if you would, because I specifically asked that question. Even commercials, if they're filmed in Wyoming, show Wyoming, and do Wyoming, it is of great economic benefit to the Department of Tourism to get the name out there. It's advertising you can't really buy. And so the niche seems to be not the big films, but the smaller films who can come in and on a smaller budget still provide a lot of financial cash to the local communities where these are filmed, still do good for Wyoming, still get the Wyoming image out there, and be able to do that. This doesn't require any more money. It just allows the threshold to be smaller, so smaller production companies, if you would, who it does really mean a lot to, can be able to come in and shoot in Wyoming and get the Wyoming product out before the public.
Thanks, Senator Larson. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, and one of the things on the committee, originally I wasn't too convinced that this program was that good of a program, but then one of the things we did here is that there's these small subcontracting companies here in Wyoming that work for the film industry that are quite affected by these film companies coming here, and they do work for them, and they hire a lot of people here in the state, these small subcontracting companies. I guess that's what you call them. They have other names for them, I think, in the film industry, but I don't remember what they were. And so it is quite an incentive program, not just for the major filmmakers themselves, but these other companies that do other work for the film companies.
Thanks, Senator Cooper. Senator Ron Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was never too happy with this bill from the very beginning when I was on TRW, and we worked to tighten it up and see if it would run, and there was $1 million, and we'll see how it happens, and now it's $2 million, and, you know, we haven't been able to spend a penny of it, and one of the reasons is we don't have the infrastructure. You're better off taking that $2 million and putting it into a film school or to buy some kind of studio arrangement, the computers, the electronics, the digital equipment they may need. You may even put a big warehouse full of rental equipment that they would use, power generators, portable generators, and I see the smile instantly on my desk-mate's face about that, but that's truly what would probably bring them here. We don't have the infrastructure. You're going to give them a couple $100,000 break. That isn't going to entice them. They can film it away from this state, have it look the same, claim it's here, and for incentives, for people that have studios already in place. BC and Canada comes to mind. But I think you really need to reach into the statutes if you want to change some of this, because one of the things it says is that the film only has to be complete to get to be able to apply for this credit. It doesn't even have to be shown. And it may include a storyline of Wyoming, Wyoming props and product placement, or a clear statement that the product, the clear statement and the credit that the production was filmed in Wyoming. Well, if we're going to get down to the point of commercials, I don't know how many commercials you see that put credits afterwards. They may get away with a quick shot of the sign says, "Welcome to Cody, Wyoming," in the commercial if they can do that. But beyond that, the average citizen somewhere else in the country may recognize the Rocky Mountains in some manner. It's a Rocky Mountain state, but are they going to really know that it is Wyoming? And if we're getting down to that level where we're going to be reimbursing commercials, we're not going to get the verification or the advertising, which translates into really good promotion for our tourism department. I'm not lying, but I understand that. If it's got a big Made in Wyoming, Shot in Wyoming, Welcome to Cody, Wyoming, all that within a film, that takes a lot of the other advertising budget money they would spend. But when you get down to the point of commercials, it's not doing us a lot of good.
Thank you, Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, when this program set up, it was take general fund dollars to give another tax exemption to a group of folks. Actually, more than that, give them a reimbursement for dollars that they might have spent towards sales tax. It was represented that by giving us approximately $2 million that we would bring in these big firms to bring in business jobs and it would help improve our image. It simply hasn't happened. And the question is if this bill had started from the beginning, would we have supported it? You know, those monies are still there. They'll come back. And if they can't deliver on what they meant, then it just wasn't meant to happen, and the dollars should come back, and we'll use them the next time we put together a budget.
Thank you, Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the program does exist. You know, if you want to change the program, that's an option out there with some other bill out there. All this bill does is lower that threshold so we can have companies come in here that are interested in producing lower budget films to qualify at the 200,000 threshold. That's all it does. Takes it from 500 to 200. If you want to restructure the whole program, I think that's for another bill for another day. But all this does is lower that threshold, so I'd urge you to support that bill.
Thank you. Are we ready for the question? All's in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the committee whole rises to report that it is with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 71, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
Senate, House Bill 71 has, excuse me, I guess we need to stand, because my understanding is it's failed. So, division having been called for, all those in favor, please rise. That was a weak aye, gentlemen and lady.
18.
All those opposed. House Bill 71 has passed committee of the whole. Next bill for our Mr. Vice President.
Chairman, I move that the committee of the whole beg leave to rise and set again in about 15 minutes.
Okay. Heard the motion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. We'll stand at leave for 15 minutes.
That's one of them must pass deals. Huh? That's one of them must pass. Must pass.
So there we go.
2. Will the reading clerk please read the bill? What'd you say?
My name's not Mike.
House Bill number 92, sponsored by Representative Landon. Long-Term Care Partnership Program, an act relating to Medicaid. It was referred to Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 92 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I'll seek to explain the bill briefly. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it says that if you buy qualified long-term care insurance, essentially insurance against going in the nursing home, will allow you to, on a dollar-for-dollar basis, and you can see that at the top of page 6, will allow you to shelter assets from recovery in the Medicaid program. Mr. Chairman, the way the Medicaid program works, it is a welfare program, but it's the way the great American middle class goes in the nursing home these days. The system is now you get rid of all your assets, and the government will pay for your nursing home bills. What this does is says, wait a minute, if you want to retain some assets, you'll buy long-term care insurance, will allow you to do that within limits. And this program, number of states had started it, and then in it works. It causes people to buy long-term care insurance. They have an incentive, so that insurance is there, kicks in. The state then doesn't have to cough up for the nursing home quite as soon. It saves us Medicaid money, plain and simple. What happened was there were 6 states that were trying one of these programs, and then the federal government, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, decided to forbid the practice. But they grandfathered in the 6 states that were already doing it. And sure enough, experience showed that it was a good deal, that it does reduce, it doesn't solve anywhere near all of your Medicaid problems, but it does reduce the expenses connected with the Medicaid program because more people have long-term care insurance because they all of a sudden have an incentive to buy it. Right now it's almost irrational to buy it because you're just supplanting money the government's otherwise going to spend. Now you have some reason to with this incentive. Well, that happened in the early 90s that the Congress forbade that, and then finally, in the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005, the Congress receded from its folly and said, okay, states, you can do this program. But being the Congress, they put some strings on it, and those strings can be seen in this bill where the basically you can see them in the piece where on page 4, starting at the top of the page, there's a certain amount of inflation protection required and that sort of thing. But that's, Mr. Chairman, that's basically all the bill does. It gives people an incentive to purchase long-term care insurance. The experience elsewhere is it does save some money for the Medicaid program. It's well worth doing. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or urge its passage.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Questions? Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question under the dollar-for-dollar of benefit paid out under the individual's long-term care partnership program certified insurance policies. I guess the reason I want to know this is if I decide to transfer my assets to my heirs, and I own a long-term care policy and have done for a long time and a very good one. How many assets can I maintain under where's the dollar for dollar? Where does it kick in? Does it kick in under the day-by-day terms of the contract, the length of the contract, the amount of money I pay for the contract, or what? Where?
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, the relevant provision is found on, starts on page 5, line 15. The state plan has to set the establish the individual's beneficiary long-term care policy. Total assets individual owned may retain under Medicaid and still qualify for benefit are increased by a dollar for each dollar of benefit paid under the long-term care policy. So it's for each dollar that the policy pays, you get to keep an extra dollar in your assets and can pass it on. I hope that answers the question.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, it does sound like a good idea in this, but I'm trying to sort out mechanically how this works, because if you want to be eligible, you're asset tested, and you're supposed to use your assets first. So it sounds to me like you have to practically use up all your assets before they start paying it. So you, I mean, if you receive benefits over maybe 4 or 5 years, 10 years, but by that time it sounds to me like your assets have already used, you've already reimbursed Medicaid, because on the first day you're reimbursing them out of each day as it goes along until your assets are exhausted, because you can't build assets fast enough to use your credit. I just wonder if there's another way to deal with it. I mean, if you buy a policy that may help you out for 5 to 6 years, 3 or 4 years, why wouldn't you get the benefit of you're anticipated to receive? But right now, mechanically, I just don't see how it sounds like you had to sell your house the first day. I'm missing something.
Chairman, I draw your attention to the bottom. Really, it starts on page 5, paragraph 17. But the real, where it addresses what I think is what we're being asked, it starts on lines 22, where it talks about the total assets an individual owns and may retain under Medicaid and still qualify for benefits under the Medicaid at the time the individual applies, and that's when theoretically, you have no assets at that time. However, if you fall under this program and say your policy can pay up to, and I'm just making up a figure, $100,000, when you apply for the Medicaid benefit, you can have $200,000 in assets that you don't have to dispose of because you qualify under this program. And, Mr. Chairman, let me also say that basically this is a waiver program. That's what they're doing. The state will apply for it, and through our insurance department, health department, we'll apply for a waiver. So the day you walk in and say, now I'm eligible for Medicaid, whatever the limits are in your insurance policy, you can have those assets still belonging to you. Otherwise, you got to be basically broke when you walk in.
Mr. Chairman, when you have a defined retirement policy in addition to your Social Security policy, in addition to your long-term care policy, and maybe I shouldn't take up other people's times over these questions, but what happens with that? Can you maintain certain amounts of your defined retirement policy under this, or does... Do you get to apply for it and then take part of your defined retirement policy against these assets? Because that's an asset for as long as you live.
Mr. Chairman, and let me see if I can give you an example of how I believe it'll work. You have either retirement policy or Social Security. And that's a steady income. You need to qualify for Medicaid because otherwise you can't afford the nursing home. Now the state takes those, that either that Social Security income or that retirement income or both, puts them in what's called a Miller Trust, uses all but about $50 of it, which is a personal needs allowance, to help defray the nursing home costs. As I read this, you will be able to shelter those proceeds on a dollar-for-dollar basis up to the level that your policy is. If it's a $50,000 policy, you'd be able to shelter up to $50,000, then you'd be out. If it's $100,000, you'd be able to shelter that amount. That's my understanding of how this would work. So it would be either the assets coming in or that stream.
Well, I understand that if you have a $50,000 policy. If you have a policy that has no top set limit, which there are some, then what are you going to get income forever? Or, I mean, you're going to shelter that, or how is that then arrived at?
Mr. Chairman, I think the federal government puts an upper limit on it, which I don't see here in the bill, but I think there is an upper limit. I think it's $250,000, but I can attempt to discover that.
Let me waste a little bit of your time with an anecdotal dialogue here. I looked some time ago about a long-term care policy. As old and as bad a shape as I was in, the policy would cost $1,200 a year, which was $100 a month. And if I went into a retirement home or a manor or whatever, they would support me in that for 3 years. $1,800 a year, I could stay in there 5 years. The average span of attendance in a retirement home, as I understand it, is about 3.5 years. When you go into one, I don't think they kick you out or anything, but that's the average of time. And you don't have to worry about any of your assets or any Social Security, or you just go in there and just have one devil of a time. Just wanted to let you know.
Thank you. All's in favor of Senator Scott's motion that when the committee hold rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 92, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
House Bill 92 has passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 156. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill number 156, sponsored by Representative Brechtel, Energy Performance Contracting 2. An act relating to economic development. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move when the committee of the whole rise to report it do so with the do pass recommendation on House Bill 156. And, Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd like to have it read in at this time.
House Bill number 156, standing committee amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 9, line 18.
Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 156. And to explain both the amendment and the bill, I'd like to call on the Senator from the Mother County, Senator Vasey.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Senator Vasey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 156 has to do with energy performance contracting. In this day and age where we need energy from all sources and lessen our dependency on certain types of energy from certain places. This bill is about conservation. The purpose of this bill is to give local governments a tool to conserve energy and capitalize on the long-term savings realized through the performance improvements. This legislation formally sets up the Wyoming Business Council as a program administrator and the clearinghouse to bring qualified energy performance companies, known as ESCOs, and applicants together in service agreements of not more than 20 years. The contracts may vary in scope and size, and these contracts deal primarily with heating, electrical, and water consumption, then the building and grounds and treatment, and so on. Larger municipalities can have this performance plan that addresses all their utility costs if they desire. Smaller subdivisions can benefit by joining together to more efficiently contract with an ESCO. Page 2 and 3 of the bill are definitions. Page 4 sets up the energy Wyoming Energy Conservation Improvement Program under the Wyoming Business Council as the administrator for development, implementation, and support performing contracts, as well as the clearinghouse that puts these people in contact with each other. On page 5, the Business Council provides a list of qualified contractors, and I want to say that, you know, this doesn't in any way exclude the Wyoming contractors that are the business, but those that are interested in these energy performances and the conservation issues of facing most government entities. In the middle of the page, the contractor sets up a performance plan with utility saving metric. At the bottom of the page, it allows for entering into installment contracts or lease agreements on energy or utility savings assets and projects. As you know, that these sometimes can be very, very expensive, so there has to be some kind of an installment over time and to do this. In the middle of page 6, the contractor provides an annual reconciliation or report card and establish who owns any liability for poor performance or the benefit of good performance. There's no appropriation in this bill, as any administrative cost is targeted to the rightful cost center. A little F on page 7 allows the business council to charge a reasonable fee for their services. Little G on page 8 allows for the contracting firm to secure and enforce any security interest they have in a project. On page 7, little h, the term of any contract will not be for more than 20 years, and the business council owes the legislature an annual report talking about how this is working and where the entities are going with this. 15.1.113 has new language to address concerns over competitive business bidding, so that otherwise this allows some governments from being able to use this service. The bill is supported by local governments, representation from the university and the Outdoor Council, and there's a lot of interest in energy and natural resource conservation. We may have an important role to play in our nation's energy futures, and maintaining an energy marketing share can only enhance our demonstrating use of the resources. The potential long-term savings to local government is huge, and the time to capitalize on the trend. And then the what the amendment does is on page 9, line 18, after costs, it inserts our capital appropriation. So that would read, without upfront capital costs or cost or capital appropriations. So I'd be glad to answer any questions, and that's the bill. We certainly do need to. Conservation has to be a critically important part of what we do with our energy needs.
Are you ready for a question on the amendment? All's in favor of Senator Larson's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 156, say aye.
Aye.
No, all those opposed, nay. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Ready for question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when a committee whole rises to report that, or do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 156, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. House Bill 156 has passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 2. Oh, my good friend Senator Jennings. Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, having voted on the prevailing side, I move for the immediate reconsideration of House Bill 96, Quiet Railroad Zones. And I ask you
to act accordingly, huh? My understanding is that a reconsideration takes a majority of the quorum present. Let's go ahead and we've got a motion on the floor. So let's go ahead and we'll take a roll call vote. This is the roll call vote on the motion to reconsider, not on the bill, but on the motion to reconsider House Bill 96, Railroad Quiet Zones. This is not on the bill. This is just for the motion to reconsider at this point. Let's go ahead and take the roll. Yes, Senator Bebout.
Just point of order. Does that require a whole report to be completed before it can be removed?
I believe Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, you have to do it at this point because once the committee of the whole report is adopted, then you've got a two-thirds motion to expunge the record.
Thanks, Senator Scott. Again, are we ready for the roll call?
There is one other way, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, point of order. You can ask for the Committee of the Whole report to be divided, and you can defeat the report on the deal, but that's one other way that this can be done. This is probably the cleanest.
Thank you, Senator Case. Are we ready for the vote? Let's take the roll call.
Anderson?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
DeCaria? Dockstader,
aye.
Esquibel,
aye.
Geis,
aye.
Hastert,
aye.
Honeycutt,
aye.
Jennings,
no.
Johnson,
no.
Landon,
aye.
Larson,
no.
Martin,
no.
Massey,
aye.
Meyer,
aye.
Nicholas,
no.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Ross,
no.
Schiffer,
no.
Scott, Sessions,
aye.
Townsend,
aye.
Basie,
no.
Von Flatern,
aye.
President Hines. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 12 ayes, 18 noes.
Motion for reconsideration has failed. So the motion for reconsideration has failed. House Bill 96 has failed. And I don't know what the language is, but that sucker's dead now, I think.
That is.
All right. We're back on House Joint Resolution number 2. Will you please read the bill?
House Joint Resolution number 2, sponsored by the Transportation Committee. Adequate funding for I-80 as a critical freight route. A joint resolution requesting that Congress adequately fund Interstate 80. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Esquibel, Geis, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Thank you. Further reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Senator Von Flatern.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation of House Joint Resolution Number 2, and to explain this, I will do that. This is an adequate funding for I-80 as a critical freight route. This is brought to you by the Joint Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs Interim Committee. It states what Interstate 80, which is was created for the interests of national defense, and whereas Interstate 80 serves as an essential link between East and West Coast, I will bring your attention to page 2, Line 4, whereas approximately half of all the traffic on Wyoming's section of Interstate 80 is a heavy commercial truck traffic that causes much greater roadway damage than the typical passenger car. And Line 10 goes into whereas the growth of heavy truck traffic on I-80 is projected to outpace the growth of passenger car traffic almost 2-1 over the next 30 years. And whereas approximately 80% of the traffic on the Wyoming span of I-80 originates and terminates outside of Wyoming, and uses Wyoming span of I-80 for the benefit of interstate commerce. And then there's a couple of whereases, and finally, now, therefore, it be resolved, members of the legislative state of Wyoming, that the federal government appropriate funds to Wyoming in such an amount so as to allow Wyoming to maintain I-80 in its best physical and safest conditions, and that the federal government recognize future demands that will be placed upon Interstate 80 and protect this nation's infrastructure by beginning to make appropriate allocations and adjustments necessary to meet this demand. As we all know, Interstate 80 is our 800-pound gorilla, and 520,000 people aren't going to be able to afford to take care of that and do our own roads. And the federal government, prior to the stimulus package, was definitely not funding it appropriately. And after this little bit of money they gave us, and we've already identified $350 million in back safety issues on I-80. So this amount of money they're giving us, which we're spreading out over many roads, is not going to be adequate at this time. It won't be adequate in the future when there isn't stimulus money. I ask for your favorable vote on House Joint Resolution 2.
Thank you. Discussion. Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flader and his motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Joint Resolution 2, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. House Joint Resolution 2 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 190.
House Bill number 190, sponsored by Representative Throne, Driver's License Suspension, Child Support, and Act relating to suspension of driver's license for non-payment of child support. It was a referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Landon, Von Flatern, excuse, Senator Geis, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Once again, Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 190, and to explain this fine bill, the Senator from Sheridan, Senator Burns.
Thank you. Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 190, Driver's License Suspensions, Child Support, actually redoes something that's already currently in the statutes. Under federal law, every state has to have a provision for at least administrative suspension of licenses in cases where child support is due and owing. The problem with the current statute in Wyoming is that it's not workable. It's not workable for a number of reasons. The statute requires a fee, but there's no way to collect the fee. The notice provisions aren't clear. The statute requires disputes to go to the Office of Administrative Hearings, and they don't have enough staff to handle the caseload of something like this. If Mr. Chairman, if you look at the handout that should be on your desks now, there's three pages to this. And you can see that currently 41 states currently have different types of license suspensions, whether it be judicial or administrative. And if you look on one of the pages, you have all the counties listed as to non-custodial parents who are more than $5,000 behind on their child support. Mr. Chairman, going into the bill itself, what this bill basically does is it changes the license suspension from administrative over to judicial. So once somebody is more than $5,000 in arrears for more than 90 days, the CSC, the, help me out with the CSC here, Child Support Enforcement can then petition the court to have their driver's license suspended. And as we go through the bill, Mr. Chairman, what it basically does, it removes the language for an administrative suspension and goes to a judicial suspension. So on page 3, you see that language that's struck out. And then when you go down to the middle of the page, That's actually the meat of the bill, line 13. If the obligor owes more than $5,000 in unpaid child support and the obligor has not made a child support payment either voluntarily or through income withholding for a period of at least 90 consecutive days prior to the determination, then they can notify them. And if they still don't hear from them, then they go to court on it. Even after that, if during that time or before the court or even after, 60 days after the court has decided this, they can still make a plan with CSE to arrange a schedule of payments. If they don't, that's when their license gets suspended, Mr. Chairman. And that's where we go. And so when they go to the hearing, and we go over to page 5 of on line 7, before the license and driving privilege of any person to be withheld, suspended, or restricted under this article, the department shall advise the licensee of the notice required under subsection F of the section of his right to appeal to the district court and any dispute involving, and then they have the list of those actual issues, the amount of current child support owed or arrearage, the identity of the obligor, name of the suspension, and the willfulness of any action or inaction of the obligor that contributed to the non-payment of the child support. And that last one, Mr. Chairman, is especially important because if the obligor just doesn't have the means to do it, that can still be taken into account. There's nothing automatic about this. This actually, Mr. Chairman, is is another tool for trying to get a number of these people who owe the money to go ahead and make their child support payments. In other states, we've had an increase of payments in Colorado of 34%. In Minnesota, they've increased collections 50%. Arkansas, they've had great success. Only 500 out of 15,000 cases have gone unaddressed. 80% increase in Delaware. South Dakota, increase by half. Mr. Chairman, this is one of those tools that's just effective in trying to bring the what is actually a major social problem into not only to resolution in a number of cases, but also to bring us into better compliance with the federal requirements. And as a matter of fact, there is money coming to the state involved in this. And Mr. Chairman, there's also a standing committee amendment, which I'd like read in at this time.
Sure, please read the amendment.
House Bill number 190, Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 3, lines 15 through 17.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment at this time and ask the chairman of the Transportation Committee to explain the amendment, please.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Von Flatern.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, line 15 through 17, delete and insert. So delete 15 through 17 on that page, which had an unpaid child support, and the obligor has not made a child support payment either voluntarily or through income withholding for a period of at least 90 consecutive days. We delete all that and just put for 90 days or more. And what this does is say if the balance is $5,000 for 90 days or more, then they fall within this and they can be penalized by loss of driver's license. What came up in committee, the discussion was on the 89th day, this person could be several thousand, six or eight or 12,000. On the 89th day, if he made a payment the way this was written, he would not fall under this particular penalty. And he'd still be accruing for the next 90 days. He would be accruing more, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000. And on the 89th day, make a payment. So what we said was if his balance is $5,000 or greater for 90 days, he falls within this. And the other stuff is pretty small. Page 3, line 19, line 18, delete determination. Page 3, line 20, after mail, insert with. So obligor to contact the obligor by certified mail with return receipt requested. That was just a cleanup there. Page 5, line 3, delete that Wyoming statute 316103A, insert. So it would read as provided in subsection F of this section to clarify where it was coming from. that particular language. And page 5, line 22, after support, find it myself, after support, insert, as used in this paragraph, willfulness means without justifiable excuse. They wanted to put a definition. If you'll see on line 20, it says the willfulness of any action or inaction of the obligor that contributed to the non-payment of child support. And then they wanted to define what willfulness means, which is, as used in this paragraph, willfulness means without justifiable excuse. And I will stand for questions. If not, I ask, call for the question.
You ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt Standing Committee Member 1 to House Bill 190, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. So the amendment has passed. Senator Burns.
Chairman, if somebody was not reading along and just went by the pronunciation of the good senator from Campbell County, it was willfulness, not wolfiness. We don't want to mix up another issue here that we don't intend to. Mr. Chairman, this legislation is not entitled to be punitive, but there is a major problem out there, and they really do need another tool to try and get some of these people to pay their child support. And in some, and in, there are a good number of cases in which they're perfectly capable of doing it, just won't.
Thanks, Senator Burns. Senator Cope.
Just a question. If you have somebody in another state out there, do they have to have this legislation in place to have reciprocity? So, like, if you know some guy's down in Florida or some other place and he hasn't paid in Wyoming where he's obligated to pay, can they take his license away like in some other state with reciprocity?
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If when you get into interstate stuff, there's already a new federal law or that we are all part of. It's called UIFSA, and that's an acronym, and I can't – it's uniform, whatever. That provides for how we assess child – if it's child support order in Wyoming, the obligor is in Florida, there's a procedure by which the paperwork is sent to Florida, and they will collect – the child support. Now, if the obligor is in Florida, it would depend on Florida law whether or not they had something with regards to suspension of driver's licenses in Florida, because he wouldn't be a resident, more than likely not a resident of the state of Wyoming, wouldn't have a Wyoming driver's license in that regard. So I hope that answers the question. I do want to point out here that this is an administrative suspension. It's the Department of Family Services, Child Support Enforcement Division, will issue the notices and so forth if you're behind, and if there's not compliance, then they direct the Department of Transportation to suspend the license, and you have a right of an appeal to the district court. So I want you to be clear that you know that this is an administrative suspension. Doesn't prohibit the court from suspending licenses, but this is allows the Department of Family Services to provide notice to DOT, and they're the ones that actually suspend the license.
Thanks, Senator Ross. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I thank the Chairman of Judiciary for straightening that out. I actually misstated it, and I thought back on what I said. A little bit completer answer also on the on other states. There are agreements between the various states on this so that, and I don't know if it goes to Florida or not, I think it is national, that if they apply for a license down there, in the system there will be a thing saying, hey, you've got a problem in Wyoming, and this has to do with more than just child support. It's a national pact, compact, I believe it is. So they say we cannot issue you a license until you straighten out your problem with Wyoming. I do not think it applies to licenses that are already issued. I don't think that other states can go and suspend their licenses unless they already have that on the books and they have some sort of reciprocity agreement with us. But if they go for a new license, if Wyoming has put their name in, then I believe there is a problem. I know there is in the Rocky Mountain West. I'm not sure if it goes nationally or not.
Thanks, Senator Burns. Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman,
Believe me, I do not have sympathy for, from what I'm about to say here, for those people who don't pay their child support at all. But, you know, I'm a little concerned with this bill, and maybe this was addressed and talked about. But, you know, it's kind of like the debtor's prison syndrome, where, you know, somebody owes some money, you put them in prison, and then they can find some way to pay their bills. And you know, I worry about this because if you have a situation where if somebody needs to have their driver's license to make a living, I realize they're not paying anyway. But I just wondered also, and maybe this doesn't even go to the bill, but I'm concerned whether our posse system is working like it should be, is that we have in place with the counties. And so I guess I wanted to know whether that was addressed. Did you have, information in the committee on this possibility of, you know, once you take a person's driver's license away, they, you know, you may not even be making it better. There's a lesser chance, I guess, of them of paying their debt, although their intent would be maybe not to pay it at all anyway. But I just wonder if you had some testimony on that.
Senator DeCaria.
Mr. Chairman, to answer that, the first point of that is that the licensee isn't even suspended for 60 days. So what they do is they contact the person who owes the child support. They send out a certified letter or service process. That person then gets it. And then they have the option. They can come in and say, okay, I'll set up a payment plan. I don't have to pay it all at once. I don't have $5,000. I mean, they don't not expecting that. And so they have an option of whether to do that. They can set up a payment plan. They can pay it in full. They can go to district court if they want. If they want to take it to court, they can take it to court. And all of those options happen before their driver's license is suspended. If they set up a payment plan, then the driver's license isn't suspended. They continue to go on. DFS and child support really doesn't have any desire to actually, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, if you put somebody out of work and they don't have any way to get money, nobody's going to come out well in that situation. And so all of those things are in there. If it's even in the case where they didn't, they can always appeal and get 120-day, say they need to go look for work, they can apply and get an exemption for 120-day temporary permit in order to drive while they go and look for work. So there are lots of safeguards in here in order to protect those non-custodial parents.
Thank you, Senator DeCaria. Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Von Flatner's motion that when the committee hold rises to report that or do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 190, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. House Bill 190 has passed committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Joint Resolution 9. Will you, reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Joint Resolution 9, sponsored by Representative Simpson. Wind Energy, a joint resolution to encourage county officials to take a proactive approach to burgeoning wind energy resource development. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations Election Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, and Johnson. No, Senator Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
Thank you. For the reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chairman. I'm not prepared. I didn't think this dog would get anywhere. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the due pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 9. There is a standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, and I would gratefully ask that it be read in at this time.
Please read the amendment.
House Joint Resolution 9, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 5.
Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, you can see that we're actually going into that section where it has a reference as to what some specific county authority. There's a statutory citation, and basically it says counties have this authority under here. And, you know, that's not the only county authority that there is in our statutes, and it's also not complete that that's all the statutory authority that we need, so we thought we'd gum it up a little bit. So we took out the reference to that specific authority in the statute, being not lawyers, and we said, whereas counties have significant authority,
and turn this into a real Gohmert. So I would ask for you to favorable, and that's probably a lot better on this bill, actually, Mr. Chairman. So I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment. I think it greatly improves the bill.
Senator Case, my assistants up here tell me you need to move the bill. Or move the amendment, please.
And I would move the Standing Committee Amendment, Mr. Chairman. And I move the bill. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on House Joint Resolution 9. I'd further move the Standing Committee Amendment to House Joint Resolution 9. I call for the question.
Thank you. Ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the that we adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Joint Resolution 9, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Amendment has passed. We're back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to yield if I could find somebody to talk about this fine bill.
We have you have a taker. Senator Larson.
Mr. Chairman, why are we telling counties what to do through a joint? Particularly through a joint resolution. They're bad enough when we send them to Congress. But to tell the counties what they should and should not be doing, give me a break.
Well, we now have liftoff. All right, let's go, Senator Burns.
Chairman, I thank the co-sponsor of the bill for those inspirational words.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, not what he said too, but what we're doing here with this is we're telling the counties to go out and now have a hodgepodge of rules all over the state. We've got people out there selling wind rights. We're developing another split estate thing out there. This is something that we ought to do, not tell the counties to go out there and get a mess of this stuff all over, and then have them come back to us and say, you told us to do it, now you fix it. So let's kill this turkey.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I was the no vote on this measure in committee. And the reason was that I felt that we were telling the counties and telling a part of the counties to use their planning and zoning authority. I think this is the way it's been used has been a bit of a problem in the some other areas run up the cost of affordable housing quite a bit. And I think you're likely to see a hodgepodge of restrictions. And given the people involved, I think you're likely to see the cost of developing wind energy go up significantly. And I think we need a general state scheme before we just turn it loose to the counties.
Further discussion? Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion when the Committee of the Whole rise to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation on House Joint Resolution 9, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay.
No.
Having nay, I heard, we need to move to standing division. All those in favor, please rise. All those opposed, please rise. To stand up, you got to okay. Pursuant to Senate Rule 11.5, having failed the standing division, the vote, a roll call vote is required. Chief Kirk will please call the roll.
Anderson, Bebout, Burns, Case, Coe, Cooper, DeCaria, no. Dockstader, no. Esquibel, no. Geis,
no.
Hastert,
aye.
Honeycutt,
no.
Jennings,
no.
Johnson,
no.
Landon,
here.
Larson,
no.
Martin,
no.
Massey,
no.
Meyer,
no.
Meyer,
no.
Nicholas,
no.
Perkins,
no.
Peterson,
no.
Ross, Schiffer,
no.
Scott,
no.
Sessions,
no.
Townsend,
no.
Basie,
no.
Von Flatern,
no.
President Hines,
no.
Cooper, aye to no. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. One aye, 29 noes.
House Joint Resolution 9, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 225. Reading clerk, please read the bill.
House Bill number 225, sponsored by Representative Harshman, Bighorn Sheep, Ewe, and Lamb Licenses, and Act Relating to Game and Fish. It was referred to Committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Cole, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Further reading of the bill, what is your pleasure? Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 225, Bighorn Sheep, Ewe, and Lamb Licenses. And to give a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the junior senator from Natrona County.
That would be me.
Oh, I'm sorry, the medium.
Thank you. Senator Jennings.
I'm one of those. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an easy bill, and I'm going to tell you all you need to know about it. All it is that right now, if you want to go bighorn sheep hunting and you get a ewe or lamb permit, it counts against your five-year waiting period before you can throw in again. They're moving, trying to capture these things, move them around for herd control. This puts it into Game and Fish. They can say, do what we do with game control, go shoot them, so, or go hunt them. It doesn't give you the right, like right now, if you draw for a bighorn sheep, you break your leg or something, you can get a postponement of your permit to go out the next year. This does not let you do that. If you get a ewe or lamb license, you got to go that year. So as you look through the bill, Mr. Chairman, you notice on page 2, line 4, it says ram, bighorn, sheep. And you can follow that all the way through the bill, Mr. Chairman, that we change that. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, we add in where we're talking about the on paragraph F. That's what we're talking about, that you can have to use it that year. And then we give the Game and Fish Commission or the department the right to sell the license. And Mr. Chairman, that's really it. So all it does is say that if you're willing to go out there and climb up down those hills to shoot a ewe or a lamb instead of a ram, that it's not going to count against your ram license, and you can go back out and put in for it again.
Thank you, Senator Jennings. We have a discussion. Are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rise to report, they do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 225, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. House Bill 225 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 297. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 297, sponsored by Representative Lubnow, Simple Assault, an Act Relating to Crime and Offenses. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Thank you. Further reading of the bill, what is your pleasure, Senator Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 297, Simple Assault, and for an explanation of the bill, I'll yield to the good senator from Fremont County.
Thank you. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 297 is, again, another bill in the area of the crime, a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. And this relates to a particular federal case. A Wyoming resident lost his firearm rights due to, you know, you have all heard it before, that if you're convicted under Wyoming law, you also come under the Lautenberg Amendments of the Brady Act, so you lose your firearm rights. The problem, and this never occurred before, is that Wyoming statute is fair in terms of assault is kind of broad. And, you know, we've always lost every time we've gone to the feds where they've always said, we don't care what it is, no matter what what the crime is, you're going to lose your firearms rights. There's no exceptions. The Hayes case is different. In the Hayes case, the defendant said, I was convicted under Wyoming law, but it wasn't so bad to come under the Lautenberg Amendment to the Brady Act. And the defendant prevailed because he said Wyoming's law is broader than and captures more and less serious crimes than the Brady Act was trying, the Lautenberg Amendment was trying to get. That's the essence of it. Here's the Hayes case. And so what has happened is that if we can create, and this bill is tailored to meet the requirements of the judge in the Hayes case. And the essence of it is that we're going to say, okay, right now we've got this as the universe of crimes of domestic violence. Right? Right now, if you're in this, you're going to fall under the Lautenberg Amendment. But the truth is, the Lautenberg Amendment is only going to try to is actually trying to catch these guys, and actually these ladies too, I'm afraid, these fathers with their children, but where there was actual physical force. And we'll get into the bill a little bit, but it's a much more serious crime than this small segment over here. Mr. Hayes was in this small segment. Truly, his act and what happened, and it's discussed in the case in detail, didn't meet the requirements. And even Lautenberg himself was quoted on the Senate floor, and he's quoted in the case as saying, you know, we're after people that hurt other people. We're not after simple touching and things like that. Mr. Chairman, what this does is create a crime of very simple assault, and it gives two different types now so that you can the prosecutor can bring a charge under this lesser side. And you can see in the bill, it says a person is guilty of an unlawful contact. It started out as being unlawful touching, and that sounded, you know, sounded like a sex offense or something like that. It's unlawful contact if he touches another person in a rude, insolent, or angry manner without, this is key, without the intent, intentionally causing or intentionally using sufficient physical force to cause bodily injury to another. An unlawful contact under this subsection is a misdemeanor punishable by imprisonment for not more than 6 months, a fine of not more than $750 or both. Mr. Chairman, that's the guts of the bill, really, is that you create this other subcategory, the same category that Mr. Hayes was in, because he was able to say in federal court that he misdemeanor assault might have been rude, insolent, or angry, but it did not intentionally use sufficient physical force to cause bodily injury. And that's what the whole case was about. There's lots of great quotes in the case. Now, Mr. Chairman, there is a Committee of the Whole amendment, and I'd like to have that read in at this time, and I'll discuss its implications.
Please read the amendment.
House Bill number 297, Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to engrossed copy, page 2, line 2.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment number 1 to House Bill 297. Mr. Chairman, this amendment is actually putting in some more language from the court case. It's brought to us by the Sheriffs and Chiefs Association. They've been working with the U.S. Attorney's Office and the group in Wyoming that represents sexual assault victims. They're all working together. They say this is the language that the bill needs to very narrowly make sure that it targets it to the Hayes case. And you can see what it really does, Mr. Chairman. The language takes and goes into that same Section G that I was discussing earlier and creates two separate requirements, and it puts in the word or. So now it's going to read, a person is guilty of unlawful contact if, little I, he touches another person in a rude, insolent, or angry manner without intentionally using sufficient force to cause bodily injury to another, comma, or, too little I, recklessly causes bodily injury to another, period. An unlawful contact under this subsection is a misdemeanor published by imprisonment for not more than 6 months. That stays the same, but it's moved down to be another subsection. Mr. Chairman, the The organization that represents police officers and or police chiefs and sheriffs in Wyoming was not able to attend the Judiciary Committee, and you were there, Mr. Chairman, but they brought this directly after the committee. They were a little late getting around that morning. And so they support this amendment. I think everybody does support the amendment. I'd be happy to answer any questions about the amendment.
Ron, Standing Committee Member 1, are we ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that the Standing Committee of the Whole adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, just one second, please. The Hayes case, so since it's, I don't know if I should actually, the essence of the case is that Mr. Hayes filed a motion to dismiss the indictment contending that the underlying conviction was not a crime of domestic violence as defined by federal law. When the district court denied the motion, Mr. Hayes conditionally pled guilty, reserving his right to appeal. He's sentenced to 18 months in prison and 3 years of supervised release. On appeal, he contends the district court erred in denying his motion. We agree and reverse. That's the whole deal in this case. And if you read the fine detail, you can absolutely see that the man, his offense did not have any use of attempted use of physical force or the threatened use of a domestic weapon. They criticize Wyoming for having too broad of a law and say it should be narrower and that... You know, it's quite clear. That's why, if you look, this is important that in this bill, there is actually a reference to the Hayes case. In Section 2, this is fairly unusual, but this is not a codified section. On the last page, it says the Wyoming legislature, cognizant of the decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit in the United States versus Hayes, creates the offense of unlawful contact in Wyoming Statute 62501G to clarify the elements of the offense of simple battery for purposes of federal law as addressed in the court's decision. That's going to be an uncodified section. It's very unusual, I suppose, to cite that case. But, Mr. Chairman, that brings it totally home and says what we're doing. This is a tool that prosecutors can use. If the case does not have the serious elements that would necessitate coming under the federal law, they can bring a charge under this section, and then a person would be able to maintain their firearm rights even though they were convicted of a misdemeanor under this section. Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Senator Case. Ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion with the Committee of the Whole rise to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 297, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. House Bill 297 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 237. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 237, sponsored by Representative Barbuto. Name changes sealed. An act relating to change of name proceedings in district court. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Sessions. No, Senators Perkins and Ross. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Ross.
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise a report, it do so with a do pass recommendation on House Bill 237. Name changes sealed, and for an explanation of the bill, I yield to Senator Burns, I believe.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, I would yield to Senator Sessions.
Senator Sessions, you have forward, lateral, or a fumble, one or the other. It's all yours.
Yeah. And Mr. Chairman, maybe I'll yield to someone else here in a few minutes. Mr. Chairman, this bill is one that I think has been around a while. This is the first time that I've ever weighed in on it, I guess, like this. But I would ask for our approval at this point in time. The first part of it on page one is it cites it's the reason for a name change, and it says that a court may allow a petition for a name change. This allows you for a sealed name change. You can go to court and ask for your name to be changed at any time, but it happens to be public record, and it happens to be a court record. And the difference in this is it may allow a petition for a name change, that for a sealed name change, and to proceed on a sealed name, sealed record basis. And then it goes on, and under what conditions may you have a sealed name change? When you apply for this, the court has to find, after you've gotten all your petition stuff in order, and it goes through and lists all the things that you have to do for this petition for a sealed name change. And then, and only then, does the court look at it and finds by a clear and convincing evidence that the safety of the petitioner's child or ward warrants sealing the file, and that the non-custodial parent was provided the opportunity to respond to the petition, or the parental rights of the non-custodial parent have been terminated. So it sets out here some pretty stringent things, and I do think now that it's been worked several times, I do think that it takes that the people that should be protected in this are protected in this. That's the non-custodial parent. And if they don't agree to it, it has to have the agreement of the non-custodial parent if the rights have not been terminated. But if the rights have been terminated, then the person, then they can ask for that sealed name change to go forward. And it also says that the court may appoint in this process a guardian ad litem to protect the best interests of the child. Then that states why we should do this and under what those really stringent, it's a very stringent basis that you can even go and ask a judge for a sealed name change. But I submit to you there are cases out there that, and there's all kinds of comments about where you can still track them and all this kind of stuff, but I still submit to you that it is, maybe it's not complete safety, but it goes away in those very egregious cases to protecting people. Then you on page 2, line 9, under B, it says, it starts to outline what must be contained in this petition and what you must do before you can even file the petition before the court. And it has to be verified by an affidavit that contains all of these following things. If the person that is asking or the person's name change that they wish to change, if they're over 17, they have to have a certified fingerprint so that they can track a criminal history under the record check pursuant to subsection E. And subsection E, Mr. Chairman, is a little bit further on in the bill that tells you exactly how you're going to do the fingerprint and then the criminal record history. And it has to be done within 90 days of the filing of the petition. That means that 2 years ago you had a fingerprint and had the criminal background check. That won't cut it for this petition. You have to have that done 90 days before you file the petition. Then it says all of this other certified copies of any court filing or from any jurisdiction in which a court has ordered child support, determined who is the parent or parental rights or orders or ordered allocation of parental responsibilities or custody regarding the petitioner. So you have to have all of the court records, all of them right there, be included within the petition. You even have to have a credit report to go with the petition. Then see, after all of you do this, then if the court looks at the petition and allows, at that point in time, after looking to all the stuff you've done, if the court allows the petition to proceed on a sealed record basis, the residency and publication requirements under WS 125-102 and 125-103 shall not apply. And those are the public record sections. And so that's, then it goes down further and tells the court all papers and records pertaining to a sealed record petition shall be kept as a permanent record of the court and can be, and shall be opened for inspection only upon an order by the court and for good cause shown upon the request of the petitioner. And then on E, this tells you how you go over to the next page, how you get the fingerprints, completed application for a criminal history check, and a full set of fingerprints. And the actual cost of the processing of all of that is required by, is borne by the applicant. Then you come under F on page 4. Then the sheriff's office, this stuff is not sent to you, the fingerprints and the criminal background sent. If I'm petitioning for a name change, it's not sent to me, it's sent to your sheriff's office, and he will forward those items to the criminal division, and then with the full set of fingerprints, and then they will do the background check. They'll submit a fingerprint card to the National Criminal Justice Information Center for a national background check. The cost of processing the fingerprints shall be payable to the division. The results of the investigation shall be sent to the sheriff's office for distribution to the applicant after the payment of any costs. So after all of these things, and I submit to you that the person asking for this, and remember we go clear back to the beginning, and the judge must find, it just can't be a willy-nilly application or somebody's desire to hide a child or yourself away. The judge has to find by a clear and convincing evidence that the safety of the petitioner or the petitioner's child or ward that their safety has to be considered. So he looks at all of the stuff, all the records, everything, records, and then looks at the nationwide fingerprint thing, and then he makes his decision. And then on page 5, it just goes into, once again, the Public Records Division. And if you have notice to be given for publication and then a verified petition to be presented, it will be sealed. It will not be done under those, it will not be allowed under our public records law under those two things. So I think it's very narrowly defined. I think someone would have to be very frightened, and I think they would have to prove a considerable amount to the court for the judge to ever even consider even hearing the petition in addition to finding in favor of the petition. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Senator Vasey.
Yes, just a question. And I understand the safety for this, but when you go to the sheriff and you go get your fingerprints and you go to the judge and you get on the national thing, do you do this under your changed name, or is that changed name a secret and you get to pick that after you've gone to? I mean, most everybody knows what you've changed your name to by that time.
Mr. Chairman, no, you have to do all of that before he will even allow you to change your name under a sealed court order. Now, if you just want to change your name, you can fill out the papers and go into a judge and it's all public record. But in order for a sealed name change to occur, you have to do all the stuff in this petition first before you go into the judge.
Senator Vasey.
Do you have to go through these petitions with the name that you want to be changed to, or can you use your own name until at such time it becomes a secret?
Mr. Chairman, how I understand it happens is everything has to be done under your name, and then when the judge accepts the petition and finds with a clear and convincing evidence that you deserve a name change, then your name is changed, and then it's sealed right there.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, I'd urge you to carefully scrutinize this bill. It was not unanimously approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee. The vote was 3-2, and I happen to be one of the no votes, along with the good chairman of the committee of the whole. I think you must weigh in this situation. We're trying to protect these individuals, and that's good. But what we allow in this bill is we allow the court to waive the residency requirement, and then we allow service by publication. So if somebody comes and they leave and they've taken their kid, maybe they've been abused and all that, and they come to Wyoming, they may not have to even be residents. How does the custodial parent actually get notice? If the custodial parent under paragraph A, which goes over onto lines 1-7, has an opportunity to respond, what good is it in reality? They've gotten their notice, and now they already know where this person's at, and they know that they want to change a name, and then where are they going to go? And what happens to the parental rights of this individual? So it's problematic. There's also an issue about creditors. What happens with creditors? Here we have to have a credit report and so forth. But what happens in the interim when they file a petition and in between? They could rack up a bunch of bills. So that it's not as simple as one would consider. And I know that we want to protect these individuals. I know they're trying to get and extricate themselves out of a very bad situation. But I submit to you that I'm not sure that this bill fully has had the scrutiny of an interim study or something like that to determine what we really want to do here, because I guess what I would tell you is one of the most fundamental rights that we have in our country is the right to associate with your children, and we guard very, very strictly that parental relationship. And so I urge you guys to take a hard look at this bill.
Thanks, Senator Ross. Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I guess this is, it's your decision, but I want you to weigh something else very carefully. We in this body have decided that maximum minimums are not what we should be doing, because we leave that to the judge. We give him the credit to look at all of this and to decide, based upon everything that we're requiring a petitioner to put forward, whether he is going to even hear this. It says he may allow a petition. So first of all, you've got to go to him with this stuff and to see if he will even allow that petition to even be heard in his court. He may allow it. So I guess what I'm asking you is, it says that the non-custodial parent. And that judge, it says right here that they have to be given a chance to respond. And the judge looks at that. And then if the parents' rights have been terminated, well, you don't want to give them a chance to respond. Their termination process, if you've ever talked to anybody who has gone through it or listened in a court case, that's a horrendous thing to do, is terminate a parent's right if the parent cares. And here, if it's once been terminated by a judge again, then you will not give them that right. So, the criminal investigation, the credit reporting and all of that stuff has to be done. It spells it out here within 90 days. I think a judge can look at, and then all the court records surrounding this child and the custodial parent, he looks at all of that from everywhere. And I think he really is capable of making a sound decision that says based upon what I see in this, this name change should be sealed. It should not be public, and it should be sealed. So here again, I guess we give judges discretion in some things, and then we don't trust them to make a logical, that we don't trust them to make a good decision under this when we're trying to protect children and women, or maybe a man.
Thanks, Senator Sessions. Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would agree with this bill if all it was talking about is a situation in which the parental rights have already been terminated. You've already had a determination. That would make sense to me. But this bill doesn't say that. That's one possibility. The other is that you have a non-custodial parent. There's inconsistency in the bill because it says that the non-custodial parent should have the opportunity to respond. So somebody comes to Wyoming, we waive the residency requirement, and then we allow service by publication on the non-custodial parent. Now, how does publication occur? Our statutes with regard to service of publication only require that it be published in a general paper of circulation in the county or the district in which the case is proceeding. What if dad or mom live in a different state? How do they get notice? How do they have an opportunity to respond? I suggest to you that they may not. And in that situation, you may not have had the opportunity to respond in that situation. You know, certainly if their parental rights have been taken away, they don't have a parent-child relationship. And I can see then in that situation where a name change would be apropos because it doesn't really have any standing in the first place. But in this situation, I suggest to you that that there is potentiality here where we may create more harm than not in terms of affecting one's parental rights. So do what you may.
Thank you, Senator Ross. Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, just on a note, and I've seen this bill a couple of times, three times, whatever. But in the interest of protecting, really protecting those people that need protected, and there are those that need to be protected, I think we could bring an amendment, and a non-custodial parent then, I guess it wouldn't happen under a sealed name change. And I guess in looking at it very carefully, I didn't understand, I've never seen the discussion where why you would include a non-custodial parent who is still around and available. I know there are many non-custodial parents who aren't even around, and they have never done the termination of parental rights under those non-custodial parents. So, but if you've got a termination of parental rights, then maybe that limits it further. I don't know. I would be willing to talk to the co-sponsors of this, or I myself will bring it and take out if there is this fear of a non-custodial parent, if his rights have not been protected, then let's do it for the people who really need it, and that is the terminated parental rights and the safety. And this is what it says in here: the judge has to consider the safety, and I think that's a number one priority.
Thank you, Senator Sessions. We're ready for the question. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when House Bill 237, whether when a committee of the House, let me start over again. Are you all in favor of Senator Ross's motion when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on House Bill 237? Say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay.
No.
Appears to the chair that the committee that House Bill 237 has failed committee of the whole. We'll go to standing division. All those in favor of the bill, please rise. All those against the bill, please rise.
Once again, we screw women.
Sent to Senate Rule 11-5, having failed standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. Will the chief clerk call the roll?
Anderson?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
No.
Coe, Cooper, DeCaria, Dockstader, Esquibel, Geis, Hastert, Honeycutt, Jennings, Johnson, Landon, Larson, Martin, Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Perkins, Peterson, Ross, Schiffer, Scott, Sessions, Townsend, Basie, Von Flatern, President Hines. Closing vote. Closing vote closed. 9 ayes, 20 noes, 1 excused.
Thank you. House Bill 237 had failed a roll call vote pursuant to Senate Rule 11-5A is deemed indefinitely postponed. Mr. Vice President.
It is. Plain, fair, and simple.
Majority floor.
Oh, excuse me. That was last year. I'm sorry. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, I apologize.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Excellent.
I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
I see. You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion opposed, nay. Motion carried.
Reading clerk, read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. House Bill 91 do pass. House Bill 252 do pass. House Bill 104 do pass amended. House Bill 291, do pass amended. House Bill 96, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 41, do pass. House Bill 42, do pass amended. House Bill 289, do pass amended. House Bill 83, do pass. House Bill 71, do pass. House Bill 92, do pass. House Bill 156, do pass amended. House Joint Resolution 2, do pass. House Bill 190, do pass amended. House Joint Resolution 9, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 225, do pass. House Bill 297, do pass amended. And House Bill 237, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senator Perkins, Chairman.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carried. Messages from the House.
February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 393, Committee of the Whole, indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 127, Junk Dealers. Ayes 19, noes 39, excused 2. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 394, conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate Joint Resolution 5. The House conferees are Representative Lockhart, Chairman, Representatives Gilmore and Stubson. February the 23rd, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 395. Conferees appointed, Joint Conference Committee number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee number 1 from the Senate on amendments to Senate File 6. The House conferees are Representative Childers, Chairman, Representatives Brown and Connolly, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Joint Conference Committee reports. Senator Schiffer, are you ready with message 342?
Yes, Mr. President, we are ready on that.
Reading clerk would please read in the message.
Joint Conference Committee report, Senate File 53, Property Tax Deferral Program. Reference House message number 342. Signing for the House, Rodney Anderson, Representative Rodney Anderson and Representative Goggle. Signing for the Senate, Senators Schiffer, Jennings, and Martin.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, I move House message number 342 on Senate file 53, Property Tax Deferral Program, and ask the Senate to vote aye. Mr. President, in essence, the House receded from their earlier position, and so we just deleted all of their amendments. So I ask you to vote aye.
The motion is that the Senate do adopt the Joint Conference Report, number 1, reference message 342, Senate File 53, and you're asked to vote aye. Chief Clerk, please call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Bebout?
Aye.
Burns?
Aye.
Case?
Aye.
Coe?
Aye.
Cooper?
Aye.
DeCaria?
Aye.
Dockstader? Esquivel, Geis, Hastert, Honeycutt, Jennings, Johnson, Landon, Larson, Martin, Massey, Meyer, Nicholas, Perkins, Peterson, Ross, Schiffer, Scott, excused. Sessions, Townsend,
aye.
Basie,
aye.
Bonflatern,
aye.
President Hines.
Aye.
Closing vote closed, 29 ayes, 1 excused.
By your vote, you have adopted the Joint Conference Committee report on message 342, reference to Senate File 53. Reports from standing committees.
February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 295, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, and Larson. Excuse, Senator Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 169, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin, Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 130, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senators Meyer and Nicholas, Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number two, Appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 176, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senator Nicholas. Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 177, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott. Senator Scott, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Mineral Business and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 161, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 23rd, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 301, engrossed, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
Signing of enrolled acts. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 161 and House Bill 295 contain appropriations, and I would like to have them re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations. House Bill 295 for about the third time, hopefully the last.
Without objections, House Bill 161 and House Bill 295 will be re-referred to Appropriations. Senate Enrolled Act Number 26.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 26 being original Senate File 42.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 26 being original Senate File Number 42. That's so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 27.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 27 being original Senate File 104.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act 27 being original Senate File Number 104. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act Number 28.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 28 being original Senate File 124.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 28 being original Senate File Number 124. I have so signed. Senate Enrolled Act 29.
Senate Enrolled Act Number 29 being original Senate File 146.
I'm about to sign Senate Enrolled Act Number 29 being original Senate File 146.
Any of it would fall in there.
I've so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 24.
House Enrolled Act Number 24 being original House Bill Number 51.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 24 being original House Bill Number 51. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act Number 25.
House Enrolled Act Number 25 being original House Bill 74.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act Number 25 being original House Number House Bill number 74. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 26.
House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill 78.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 26, being original House Bill number 78. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 27.
House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill 79.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 27, being original House Bill number 79. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 28.
House Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill 106.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 28, being original House Bill number 106. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 29.
House Enrolled Act number 29, being original House Bill 113.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 29, being original House Bill 113. That's so signed. House Enrolled Act number 30.
House Enrolled Act number 30, being original House Bill number 135.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 30, being original House Bill number 135. I've so signed. House Bill Enrolled Act number 31.
House Enrolled Act number 31, being original House Bill number 137.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 31, being original House Bill number 137. Yep. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 32.
House Enrolled Act number 32, being original House Bill 150.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 32, being original House Bill number 150. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 33.
House Enrolled Act number 33, being original House Bill 155.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 33, being original House Bill number 155. I'm so signed. House Enrolled Act number 34.
House Enrolled Act number 34, being original House Bill number 182.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 34, being original House Bill number 182. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 35.
House Enrolled Act number 35, being original House Bill number 221.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 35, being original House Bill 221. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 36.
House Enrolled Act number 36, being original House Bill 2.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 36, being original House Bill number 2. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 37.
House Enrolled Act number 37, being original House Bill 10.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 37 be an original House Bill number 10. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 38.
House Enrolled Act number 38 being original House Bill 16.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 38 being original House Bill number 16. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 39.
House Enrolled Act number 39 being original House Bill 34.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 39 being original House Bill number 34. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 48. House Enrolled Act number 40.
House Enrolled Act number 40 being original House Bill 48.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 40 being original House Bill number 48. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 41.
House Enrolled Act number 41 being original House Bill 75.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 41 being original House Bill number 75. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 42.
House Enrolled Act number 42 being original House Bill 80.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 42 being original House Bill number 80. I have so signed. House Enrolled Act number 43.
House Enrolled Act number 43 being original House Bill 100.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 43, be an original House Bill number 100. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 44.
House Enrolled Act number 44, being original House Bill 111.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 44, be an original House Bill number 111. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 45.
House Enrolled Act number 45 being original House Bill 145.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 45 being original House Bill number 145. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act, number 46.
House Enrolled Act number 46 being original House Bill 195.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 46 being original House Bill number 195. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 47.
House Enrolled Act number 47 being original House Bill 235.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 47 being original House Bill number 235. I'm so signed. House Enrolled Act number 48.
House Enrolled Act number 48 being original House Bill 241.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 48, be an original House Bill number 241. I've so signed. House Enrolled Act number 49.
House Enrolled Act number 45, being original House Bill 251.
I'm about to sign House Enrolled Act number 49, being original House Bill number 251. So signed. Mr. Majority, floor leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate be adjourned until 10 a.m., 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources.
We'll meet up on adjournment on Tuesday night in S-15 with a joint meeting with the House to look at interim topics.
Senator Cove.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock right over here in S-11 by the smoking lounge to hear House Bill 174, Engrossed Provisional Opportunity Hathaway Scholarship, House Bill 69, Engrossed Driver's Education Program Funding, House Bill 249, Engrossed Public Education Accountability, and House Bill 108, Engrossed Student Activities Participation Fees.
Senator Von Vladeren.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs will meet in 10 minutes. The top of the hour at 6 for House Bill 267, Engrossed Commercial Motor Vehicle Definitions, House Bill 211, Engrossed Veterans License Plates.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Corporations Committee will not meet tomorrow, and we'll get a notice out for our meeting on Thursday when we'll discuss some interim topics and some other work. But, Mr. President, the Conference Committee on Senate File 117 will meet 9 a.m. tomorrow in H-17. That's the House Labor Room. And Senate File 117 is Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Act Eligibility. Thank you, Mr. President.
Senator Larson.
President, your Conference Committee on Message Number 315, Senate File 111, will meet tomorrow on the noon recess up in S-18. And further, Mr. Chairman, your Committee Number 9, Mr. President, your Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet Wednesday, 30 minutes after the noon recess in S-18, to discuss House Bill 239, Engrossed Bighorn Basin Discovery Center, and also to discuss possible interim topics.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, Tuesday, February 24th, 30 minutes after noon recess, up in S-16, to take up House Bill 184, Engrossed Mineral Taxes, Audit and Refund, House Bill 244, Engrossed Uncompensated Trauma Care, and House Bill 234, Engrossed Property Tax Assessed Value. And if we get time, we'll talk about interim topics.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. Committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet upon adjournment today in room 204 on this floor to consider House Bill 114, Engrossed Community Colleges Amendments. The committee meets tomorrow at 1 p.m. to consider House Bill 118, Engrossed Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, House Bill 180, Engrossed Public Transit Accounting Funding, and House Bill 299, Engrossed School Facilities Budget Process. The committee then meets upon adjournment to consider House Bill 213, Engrossed Rangeland Monitoring, House Bill 54, Engrossed Workers' Compensation Amendments, and House Bill 68, Engrossed Property Tax Homestead Exemption.
Senator Dr. Spatter.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Conference Committee on House Bill 11, Dogs Chasing Wildlife, will meet 10 minutes after House adjournment tomorrow, Tuesday, in room H-10.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. President. For those of you that ordered mugs for the 60th Legislature, Representative Throne has them over in the House, and she asked that you come over and pick them up. And she did order a few extras if you were unable or missed the earlier email on ordering the mugs. So they're in.
Mr. Majority, floor leader.
Thank you, Mr. President. A few last-minute announcements, and I would take note that tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock, we'll have a majority party caucus to go over the governor's appointments, which you received today. That's tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to go over the governor's appointments. Committee chairs, a reminder that the interim topic proposals are due Monday at 2 p.m. So, and as I heard in some of the announcements, you're already starting to work on those. The other announcement is that Whammy, the dinner for tomorrow, those folks need to know if you're going to bring a spouse or a guest. If you are, Sandy, the leadership secretary, I'll be glad to respond for you, but let Sandy know what your plans are in terms of guest or spouse for that Whammy dinner tomorrow night. And finally, plan on a 9 o'clock take-up on Wednesday morning. Thank you.
Senator Hastert.
Mr. President, thank you. The minority party will also be caucusing at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning in the usual caucus room.
You've heard the motion that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Tuesday, February 24th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.